Chapter 21. They all came up from the lower levels, all of the ones who had stayed at the temple hanging in air after most of the work had been finished. Ania and Abedik, Rachel and Theo, George and Jigme, Kuku and Kay, Chimdin and Gyalo Thondup, Lomo and Lobsang, Kim Byung-soon and Vicky Groselge, Kenshiro and Hariyuki, Master Abbot Kempo Nga Wang Tashi and his master, the young Dalai Lama, Wojtek Meyer and Janusz Kurtika, brooding Rimzi Kiyopup, and grinning Chang-Chi Kenchung, the Dorje Famo the Thunderbolt Sao, and Carl Linga William Iheiji. Ania came to my side and slipped her hand in mine as we watched the skies in awed silence. I am surprised that we were not all blinded by the light show going on up there where the stars had been a moment earlier. Great blossoms of white light, strobes of sulfur yellow, blazing red streaks, far brighter than a comet or meteor's tail, crisscrossed with blue, green, white, and yellow slashes, each as clear and straight as a diamond scratch on glass, then sudden bursts of orange that seemed to fold into themselves in silent implosions, followed by more white strobes and a resumption of red slashes. It was all silent. But the violence of light alone made us want to cover our ears and cringe in a sheltered place. "What in 10 hells is it?" asked Lomo Dondrub.
"Space battle," said Ania. Her voice sounded terribly tired.
"I do not understand," said the Dalai Lama.
He did not sound afraid, merely curious.
"The Pax authorities assured us that they would have only one of their starships in orbit, the Jibril, I believe is its name, and that it was on a diplomatic mission rather than a military one. Regent Retting Tokra also assured me of this."
The Thunderbolt Sao made a rude noise.
"Your Holiness, the Regent is in the pay of the Pax bastards."
The boy looked at her.
"I believe it to be true, Your Holiness," said Iheiji, his bodyguard. "I have heard things in the palace."
The sky had faded almost to black, but now it exploded again in a score of places. The rocky cliff face behind us bled reflections of red, green, and yellow.
"How can we see their laser lances if there is no dust or other colloidal particles to highlight them?" asked the Dalai Lama, his dark eyes bright.
Evidently the news of his regent's betrayal was not surprising to him, or at least not as interesting as the battle going on thousands of kilometers above us. I was interested to see that the supreme holy person of the Buddhist world had been tutored in basic science. Again, it was his bodyguard who answered.
"Some ships must have been hit and destroyed already, Your Holiness," said Iheiji. "The coherent beams and CPBs would become visible in the expanding fields of debris, frozen oxygen, molecular dust, and other gases."
This caused a moment of silence in our group.
"My father watched this once on Hyperion," whispered Rachel.
She rubbed her bare arms as if there had been a sudden chill. I blinked and looked at the young woman. I had not missed Ania's comment about her friend's father, Saul. I knew my Kantos well enough to identify Rachel as the infant on the legendary Hyperion pilgrimage, daughter of Saul Weintraub. But I admit that I had not completely believed it. The infant Rachel had become the almost mythical woman Moneta in the Kantos, someone who had traveled back in time in the time tombs with the Shrike. How could that Rachel be here now? Ania put her arm around Rachel's shoulders.
"My mother is well," she said softly. Only then it was thought to be the hegemony forces against the ousters.
"Who is this then?" demanded the Dalai Lama. "The ousters against the Pax? And why have the Pax warships come unbidden to our system?"
Several white spheres of light pulsed, grew, dimmed, and died. We all blinked away the retinal echoes.
"I believe that the Pax warships were here since their first ship arrived, Your Holiness," said Ania. "But I do not think that they are fighting ousters."
"Who then?"
said the boy. Ania turned her face back to the sky.
"One of their own," she said.
Suddenly there came a series of explosions quite different than the others. A closer, brighter series of explosions, followed by 3 blazing meteor trails. One exploded quickly in the upper atmosphere, trailing a score of minor debris trails that quickly died out. The second shot to the west, blazing from yellow to red to pure white, breaking up 20 degrees above the horizon and spilling 100 lesser trails across the cloudy western horizon. The third screeched across the sky from west of the zenith to the eastern horizon, and I say screeched deliberately, because we could hear the noise, at first a teakettle whistle, then a howl, then a terrible tornadic roar, diminishing as quickly as it came, finally to break up into 3 or 4 large blazing masses in the east, all but one of which died out before reaching the horizon. This last burning fragment of starship seemed to wiggle in its flight at the last moment, with yellow bursts of light preceding it, slowing it, before it was lost to sight. We waited another half hour on the upper platform, but except for dozens of fusion flame streaks for the first few minutes, starships accelerating away from Tian Shan, I knew, there was nothing left to see. Eventually, the stars were once again the brightest things in the sky, and everyone moved off. The Dalai Lama to sleep in the monks' quarters here, others to permanent or temporary quarters on the lower levels. Ania bid a few of us to stay, Rachel and Theo, A. Betic and Lomo Dondrub, and me. "That is the sign I've been waiting for," she said very softly when all the others had left the platform. "We must leave tomorrow."
"Leave," I said. "To where? Why?"
Ania touched my forearm. I interpreted this as saying, "I will explain later." I shut up as the others spoke.
"The wings are ready, teacher," said Lomo.
"I have taken the liberty of checking over the skin suits and rebreathers in M. Endymion's quarters while you are all away," said A. Betic. "They are all serviceable."
"We'll finish up the work and organize the ceremony tomorrow," said Theo.
"I wish I were going," said Rachel.
"Going where?" I said again, despite my best efforts to shut up and listen.
"You're invited," said Ania, still touching my arm. That did not really answer my question. "Lomo and A. Betic, if you're both still game."
Lomo Dondrup gave his broad grin. The android nodded. I began to think that I was the only one in the temple compound that didn't understand what was going on.
"Good night, all," said Ania. "We'll be off at first light. You don't need to see us off."
"To hell with that," said Rachel. Theo nodded agreement. "We'll be there to say goodbye," continued Rachel.
Ania nodded and touched their arms.
Everyone clambered down ladders or slid down cables.
Ania and I were alone on the top platform. The sky seemed dark after the battle. I realized that clouds had risen above the ridgeline and were wiping the stars away like a wet towel drawn across a black slateboard. Ania opened the door to her sleeping room, went in, lit the lantern, and returned to stand in the entrance.
"Coming, Rall?"
We did talk, but not right away. Lovemaking seems all too absurd when described. Even the timing of our lovemaking seems absurd in the telling, with the sky literally falling and my lover having carried out a sort of Last Supper convocation that night. But lovemaking is never absurd when you are making love to the person you truly love. And I was. If I had not realized that before the Last Supper night, I did then. Completely, totally, and without reservation. It was perhaps 2 hours later when Ania pulled on a kimono and I donned a yukata and we moved away from the sleeping mat to the open shoji screens. Ania brewed tea on the small burner set in the tatami, and we took our cups and sat with our backs against the opposing shoji frames, our bare toes and legs touching, my right side and her left knee extending over the kilometers-long drop. The air was cool and smelled of rain, but the storm had moved north of us. The summit of Hang Shan was shrouded with clouds, but all the lower ridges were illuminated by a constant play of lightning.
"Is Rachel really the Rachel from the Kantos?" I said. It was not the question I most wanted to ask, but I was afraid to ask it.
"Yes," said Ania.
She's the daughter of Saul Weintraub, the woman who caught the Merlin sickness on Hyperion and aged backward 27 years to the infant whom Saul brought on the pilgrimage.
And she was also known as Moneta, I said. And Memnosine?
Admonisher, murmured Anea. And Memory. Appropriate names for her role in that time.
That was 280 years ago, I said, and scores of light years away on Hyperion. How did she get here?
Anea smiled. The warm tea breathed vapors that rose to her tousled hair. I started life more than 280 years ago, she said, and scores of light years away, on Hyperion.
So did she get here the same way you did, through the time tombs?
Yes and no, said Anea. She held up one hand to stop my protest. I know that you want straight talk, Rawl. No parables or similes or evasions. I agree, the time for plain talk is here. But the truth is that the Sphinx time tombs are only part of Rachel's journey.
I waited.
You remember the Kantos, she began.
I remember that the pilgrim named Saul took his daughter. After the Keats persona somehow saved her from the Shrike, and after she began aging normally. Took her into the Sphinx, into the future. I stopped. This future?
No, said Anea. The infant Rachel grew into a child again, a young woman again, in a future beyond this one. Her father raised her a second time. Their story is marvelous, Rawl, literally filled with marvels.
I rubbed my forehead. The headache had gone, but now it threatened to return. And she got here via the time tombs again, I said, moving back in time with them?
Partially via the time tombs, said Anea. She is also able to move through time on her own.
I stared. This bordered on madness. Anea smiled as if reading my thoughts or just reading my expression.
I know it seems insane, Rawl. Much of what we've yet to encounter is very strange.
That's an understatement, I said. Another mental tumbler clicked into place. Theo Bernard, I said.
Yes?
There was a Theo in the Kantos, wasn't there? I said, a man. There were different versions of the oral tale, the poem to be sung, and many of these minor details were dropped in the short, popular versions. Grandam had made me learn most of the full poem, but the dull parts had never held my interest.
Theo Lane, said Anea. At one time the consul's aide on Hyperion, later our world's first governor-general for the hegemony. I met him once when I was a girl. A decent man, quiet. He wore archaic glasses.
This Theo, I said, trying to figure it all out. Some sort of sex change?
Anea shook her head. Close, but no cigar, as Freud would have said.
Who?
Theo Bernard is the great-great-great, etc., granddaughter of Theo Lane, said Anea. Her story is an adventure in itself, but she was born in this era. She did escape from the Pax colonies on Maui Covenant and join the rebels, but she did so because of something I told the original Theo almost 300 years ago. It had been passed down all those generations. Theo knew that I would be on Maui Covenant when I was...
How? I said.
That's what I told Theo Lane, said my friend, when I would be there. The knowledge was kept alive in his family, much as the Shrike pilgrimage has been kept alive by the Kantos.
So you can see the future, I said flatly.
Futures, corrected Anea. I've told you I can, and you heard me tonight.
You've seen your own death?
Yes.
Will you tell me what you've seen?
Not now, Rawl, please, when it's time.
But if there are futures... I said, hearing the growl of pain in my own voice. Why do you have to see one death for yourself? If you can see it, why can't you avoid it?
I could avoid that particular death, she said softly, but it would be the wrong choice.
How can life over death ever be the wrong choice? I said. I realized that I had shouted it. My hands were balled into fists.
She touched those fists with her warm hands, surrounding them with her slender fingers. That's what all this is about, she said so softly that I had to lean forward to hear her. Lightning played on the shoulders of Hang Shan. Death is never preferable to life, Rawl, but sometimes it's necessary. I shook my head. I realized that I must look sullen at that moment, but I didn't care. "Will you tell me when I'm going to die?" I said. She met my gaze. Her dark eyes held depths. "I don't know," she said simply. I blinked. I felt vaguely hurt. Didn't she care enough to look into my future? "Of course I care," she whispered. "I've just chosen not to look at those probability waves. Seeing my death is difficult. Seeing yours would be..." She made a strange noise, and I realized that she was weeping. I moved around on the tatami mat until I could put my arms around her. She leaned in against my chest. "I'm sorry, kiddo," I said into her hair, although I could not have said exactly what I was sorry about. It was strange to feel so happy and so miserable at the same time. The thought of losing her made me want to scream, to throw rocks at the mountainside. As if echoing my feelings, thunder rumbled from the peak to the north. I kissed her tears away. Then we just kissed, the salt of her tears mingling with the warmth of her mouth. Then we made love again, and this time it was as slow, careful, and timeless as it had been urgent earlier. When we were lying in the cool breeze again, our cheeks touching, her hand on my chest, she said, "You want to ask something? I can tell it." "What?" I thought of all the questions I had been filled with during her discussion time earlier. All of her talks I had missed, that I needed to catch up on in order to understand why the communion ceremony was necessary. What is the cruciform really about? What is the Pax up to on those worlds with missing populations? What does the Corps really hope to gain in all this? What the hell is the Shrike? Is the thing a monster or a guardian? Where did it come from? What's going to happen to us? What does she see in our future that I need to know in order for us to survive, in order for her to avoid the fate she has known about since before she was born? What's the giant secret behind the void which binds, and why is it so important to connect with it? How are we going to get off this world if the Pax really slagged the only Farcaster portal under molten rock, and there are Pax warships between the Consul's ship and us? Who are these observers she talked about, who have been spying on humanity for centuries? What's all this about learning the language of the dead and so forth? Why haven't the Nemes thing and her clone siblings killed us yet? I asked. "You've been with someone else? Made love with someone before me?" This was insanity. It was none of my business. She was almost 22 standard years old. I'd slept with women before. I could not remember any of their last names, but in the Home Guard, while working in the Nine Tails Casino, why should I care if, what difference did it make if, I had to know? She hesitated only a second. "Our first time together was not my first," she said. I nodded, feeling like a swine and a voyeur for asking. There was an actual pain in my chest, much as I had imagined angina from hearing about it. I could not stop. "Did you love him?" How did I know it was a he? Theo? Rachel? She surrounds herself with women. My own thoughts made me sick of myself. "I love you, Rawl," she whispered. It was only the second time she had said this, the first being when we had said goodbye on old Earth more than 5.5 years earlier. My heart should have soared at the words, but it hurt too much. There was something important here that I did not understand. "But there was a man," I said, the words like pebbles in my mouth. "You loved him." "Only one? How many?" I wanted to scream at my thoughts to shut up. Anea put her finger on my lips. "I love you, Rawl. Remember that as I tell you these things. Everything is complicated by who I am, by what I must do. But I love you. I have loved you since the first time I saw you in the dreams of my future. I loved you when we met in the dust storm on Hyperion, with the confusion and shooting and the Shrike and the hawking mat. Do Do you remember how I squeezed my arms around you when we were flying on the mat, trying to escape? I loved you then. I waited in silence. Aeneas' finger moved from my lips to my cheek. She sighed as if the weight of the worlds were on her shoulders. All right, she said softly. There was someone. I've made love before. We...
Was it serious? I said. My voice sounded strange to me, like the ship's artificial tones.
We were married, said Aeneas.
Once, on the river Khans on Hyperion, I'd gotten into a fist fight with an older bargeman who was half again my weight, with infinitely more experience in fighting. With no warning, he had clipped me under the jaw with a single blow that had blacked out my vision, buckled my knees, and sent me reeling back over the barge railing into the river. The man had held no grudge and had personally dived in to fish me out. I'd regained consciousness in a minute or two, but it was hours before I could shake the ringing out of my head and truly focus my eyes. This was worse than that. I could only lie there and look at her, at my beloved Aeneas, and feel her fingers against my cheek, as strange and cold and alien as a stranger's touch. She moved her hand away. There was something worse.
The 23 months, 1 week and 6 hours that were unaccounted for, she said.
With him?
I could not remember forming the two words, but I heard them spoken in my voice. Yes.
Married, I said, and could not go on.
Aeneas actually smiled, but it was the saddest smile I think I had ever seen. By a priest, she said. The marriage will be legal in the eyes of the Pax and the Church.
Will be?
Is.
You're still married? I wanted to get up then and be sick over the edge of the platform, but I could not move.
For a second, Aeneas seemed confused, unable to answer.
Yes,
she said, her eyes gleaming with tears. I mean, no, I'm not married now. You...
Damn it, if I could only... But the man's still alive, I interrupted, my voice as flat and emotionless as a Holy Office Inquisition interrogator's.
Yes. She put her hand on her own cheek. Her fingers were trembling.
Do you love him, kiddo?
I love you, Rol.
I pulled away slightly, not consciously, not deliberately, but I could not stay in physical contact with her while we had this discussion.
There's something else, she said.
I waited.
We had... I had a child, a baby.
She looked at me as if trying to force understanding of all this through her gaze directly into my mind. It did not work.
A child, I repeated stupidly. My dear friend.
My child friend turned woman turned lover. My beloved had a child. How old is it? I said, hearing the banality like the thunder rumbling closer.
Again she seemed confused, as if uncertain of facts. Finally she said, "The child is nowhere I can find it now."
"Oh, kiddo," I said, forgetting everything but her pain. I folded her against me as she wept. "I'm so sorry, kiddo. I'm so sorry," I said as I patted her head. She pulled back, wiping away tears.
No, Rol, you don't understand. It's all right. It's not... That part's all right.
I pulled away from her and stared. She was distraught, sobbing. I understand. I lied.
Rol.
Her hand felt for mine. I patted her hand but got out of the bedclothes, pulled on my clothes, grabbed my climbing harness and pack from their place by the door.
Rol.
I'll be back before dawn, I said, facing in her general direction but not looking at her. I'm just going for a walk.
Let me go with you, she said, standing with the sheet around her. Lightning flashed behind her. Another storm was coming in.
I'll be back before dawn,
I said, and went out the door before she could dress or join me. It was raining, a cold, sleety rain. The platforms were quickly coated and made slick. I hurtled down ladders and jogged down the vibrating staircases, seeing my way by the occasional lightning flash, not slowing until I was several hundred meters down the east ledge walk, headed toward the fissure, where I had first landed in the ship. I did not want to go there. Half a click from the temple were fixed lines rising to the top of the ridge. The sleet was pounding on the cliff face now. The red and black lines were coated with a layer of ice. I clipped carabiners onto the line and harness, pulling the powered ascenders from the pack and attaching them without double-checking the connections, then began jumaring up the icy ropes. The wind came up, whipping my jacket and pushing me away from the rock wall. Sleet pounded at my face and hands. I ignored it and ascended, sometimes sliding back 3 or 4 meters as the Jumar clamps failed on the icy line, then recovering and climbing again. 10 meters below the razor's edge summit of the ridgeline, I emerged from the clouds like a swimmer coming up out of the water. The stars still burned coldly up there, but the billowing cloud masses were piling against the north wall of the ridge and rising like a white tide around me. I slid the ascenders higher and jumared until I reached the relatively flat area where the fixed lines were attached. Only then did I notice that I had not tied on the safety line. "Fuck it," I said, and began walking northeast along the 15-centimeter-wide ridge line. The storm was rising around me to the north. The drop to the south was kilometers of empty black air. There were patches of ice here, and it was beginning to snow. I broke into a trot, running east, jumping icy spots and fissures, not giving a good goddamn about anything. While I was obsessed with my own misery, there were other things occurring in the human universe. On Hyperion, when I was a boy, news filtered slowly from the interstellar packs to our moving caravans on the moors. An important event on Pachem or Renaissance Vector or wherever would, of necessity, be many weeks or months old from Hawking Drive time debt, with additional weeks of transit from Port Romance or another major city to our provincial region. I was used to not paying attention to events elsewhere. The lag in news had lessened, of course, when I was guiding off-world hunters in the fens and elsewhere, but it was still old news and of little importance to me. The packs held no fascination for me, although off-world travel certainly had. Then there had been almost 10 years of disconnection during our old Earth hiatus and my 5 years of time debt odyssey. I was not used to thinking of events elsewhere except where they affected me, such as the packs' obsession with finding us. But this would soon change. That night on Tian Shan, the Mountains of Heaven, as I ran foolishly through sleet and fog down the narrow ridgeline, these were some of the events happening elsewhere. On the lovely world of Maui Covenant, where the long chain of events culminating with my presence here with Ania could be said to have begun with the courtship of Ciri and Merin some 4 centuries ago, rebellion raged. The rebels on the Motile Isles had long since become followers of Aeneas' philosophy, had drunk of her communion wine, had rejected the Pax and the Cruciform forever, and were waging a war of sabotage and resistance while trying not to harm or kill the Pax soldiers occupying the world. For the Pax, Maui Covenant offered special problems because it was primarily a vacation world. Hundreds of thousands of wealthy born-again Christians traveled there via Hawking Drive every standard year to enjoy the warm seas, the beautiful beaches of the equatorial archipelago isles, and the dolphin motile isles migrations. The packs also benefited from the hundreds of oil drilling platforms around the mostly ocean world, situated out of sight of tourist areas, but vulnerable to attack from motile isles or rebel submersibles. Now many of the packs' tourists themselves were, inexplicably, rejecting the cruciform and becoming followers of Aeneas' teachings, rejecting immortality. The planetary governor, the resident archbishop, and the Vatican officials called in for the crisis could not understand it.
on cold Sol Draconi Septim, where most of the atmosphere was frozen into a single giant glacier. There were no tourists. But the Pack's attempt at colonization there over the past 10 years had turned into a nightmare. The gentle bands of Chichituk, whom Ania Abetic and I had befriended some 9.5 years ago, had turned into implacable foes of the Pack's. The skyscraper frozen into the atmospheric ice, where Father Glaucus had welcomed all travelers, still blazed with light, despite that kind man's murder at the hand of Radamanth Nemes. The Chichituk kept the place alight like a shrine. Somehow they knew who had murdered the harmless blind man and Chuchiat's tribe. Chuchiat, Chaku, Aichakut, Chuchtu, Chithisya, Chacha. All of those whom Ania Abetic and I had known by name. The other Chichituk blamed the Pacs, who were attempting to colonize the temperate bands along the equator where the air was gaseous and the great glacier melted down to the ancient permafrost. But the Chichituk, not having heard of Ania's communion and tasted the empathy of it, descended on the Pacs like a biblical plague. Having preyed upon and been preyed upon by the terrible snow wraiths for millennia, the Chichituk now drove the tunneling white beasts south to the equatorial regions, unleashing them on the Pax colonists and missionaries. The toll was frightful. Pax military units, brought in to kill the primitive Chichituk, sent patrols out onto and into the planet Glacier and never saw them again. On the city planet of Renaissance Vector, Ania's word of the void which binds had spread to millions of followers. Thousands of Pax faithful took communion from the changed ones every day, their cruciforms dying and falling off within 24 hours, sacrificing immortality for what? The Pax and Vatican did not understand, and at that time neither did I. But the Pax knew that it had to contain the virus. Troopers kicked in doors and crashed through windows every day and night, usually in the poorer, old industrial sections of the planet-wide city. These people who had rejected the cruciform did not strongly resist. They would fight fiercely, but refused to kill if there was any way to avoid it. The Pax troopers did not mind killing to carry out their orders. Thousands of Ania's followers died the true death, former immortals who would never see resurrection again. And tens of thousands were taken into custody and sent to detention centers, where they were placed into cryogenic fugue lockers so that their blood and philosophy could not contaminate others. But for every one of Ania's adherents killed or arrested, dozens, hundreds, stayed safe in hiding, passing along Ania's teachings, offering communion of their own changed blood, and providing largely nonviolent resistance at every turn. The great industrial machine that was Renaissance Vector had not yet broken down, but it was lurching and grinding in a way not seen in all the centuries since the hegemony established the world as the web's industrial nexus. The Vatican sent more troops and debated as to how to respond. On Tau Ceti Center, once the political center of the world web but now just a heavily populated and popular garden planet, the rebellion took a different shape. While off-world visitors had brought Ania's anti-cruciform contagion, the bulk of the problem there for the Vatican centered on the Archbishop Aquila Silvaski, a scheming woman who had taken over the role of governor and autocrat on TC Squared more than 2 centuries earlier. It was Archbishop Silvaski who had attempted to overthrow the re-election of the permanent pope through intrigue among the cardinals, and now, having failed at that, she simply staged her own planet-wide version of the pre-Hegira Reformation, announcing that the Catholic Church on Tau Ceti Center would henceforth recognize her as pontiff and be forever separated from the corrupt interstellar Church of the Pax. Because she had carefully formed an alliance with the local bishops in charge of resurrection ceremonies and machineries, she could control the sacrament of resurrection, and thus the local church. More importantly, the archbishop had wooed the local Pax military authorities with land, wealth, and power, until an unprecedented event occurred. A Pax fleet, Pax military coup that overthrew most senior officers in Tau Ceti system and replaced them with new church advocates.
No Archangel starships were seized this way, but 18 cruisers and 41 torchships committed themselves to defending the new church on TC Squared and its new pontiff. Tens of thousands of faithful church members on the planet protested. They were arrested, threatened with excommunication, i.e. immediate revocation of their cruciforms, and released on probation under the watchful eye of the archbishops, new popes, new church security force. Several priestly orders, most notably the Jesuits on Tau Ceti Center, refused to comply. Most were quietly arrested, excommunicated, and executed. Some hundreds escaped, however, and used their network to offer resistance to the new order, at first nonviolent, then increasingly severe. Many of the Jesuits had served as priest officers in the Pax's military before returning to civilian clerical life, and they used their military skills to create havoc in and around the planet. Pope Urban XVI and his Pax fleet advisors looked at their options. Already the crushing blow in the Great Crusade against the Austers had been delayed and derailed by Captain de Soya's continued harassing attacks, by the need to send fleet units to a score of worlds to quell the Aenea contagion rebellions, by the logistical requirements for the ambush in Tian Shan system, and now by this and other unrelated rebellions. Over Admiral Maryusin's advice to ignore the Archbishop's heresy until after other political military goals were reached, Pope Urban XVI and his Secretary of State, Lord Usami, decided to divert 20 archangels, 32 old-style cruisers, 8 transport ships, and 100 torch ships to Tau Ceti system, although it would be many weeks of time debt before the old Hawking Drive ships could arrive. Once formed up in that system, the task force's orders were to overcome all resistance by rebellious spacecraft, establish orbit around TC Squared, demand the Archbishop's immediate surrender and the surrender of all those who supported her, and, failing compliance with that order, to slag as much of the planet as it took to destroy the new church's infrastructure. After that, tens of thousands of Marines would drop to the planet to occupy the remaining urban centers and to re-establish the rule of the Pax and the Holy Mother Church. On Mars, in old Earth system, the rebellion had worsened, despite years of Pax bombardment from space and constant military incursions from orbit. 2 standard months earlier, Governor Claire Paulo and the Archbishop Robeson had both died the true death in a nuclear suicide attack on their palace in exile on Phobos. The Pax's response had been terrifying. Asteroids diverted from the nearby belt and dropped on Mars. Carpet plasma bombing and nightly lance attacks that sliced through the new planetary dust storm kicked up by the asteroid bombardment like so many deadly searchlights crisscrossing the frozen desert. Death beams would have been more efficient, but the Pax fleet planners wanted to make an example of Mars and wanted it to be a visible example. The results were not exactly what the Pax had hoped for. The Martian terraforming environment, already precarious after years of poor maintenance, collapsed. Breathable atmosphere on the world was now restricted to Hellas Basin and a few other low pockets. The oceans were gone, boiled away as the pressure dropped, or frozen back in the poles and permafrost subcrust. The last large plants and trees died off until only the original brandy cactus and Bradbury orchards were left clinging to life in the near vacuum. The dust storms would last for years, making Pax marine patrols on the Red Planet all but impossible. But the Martians, especially the militant Palestinian Martians, were adapted to such a life and ready for this contingency. They hunkered down, killed the Pax troopers when they landed, and waited. Templar missionaries among the other Martian colonies urged the final nanotech adaptation to the original planetary conditions. Thousands and thousands took the gamble, allowing the molecular machines to alter their bodies and DNA to the planet. More disturbingly to the Vatican, space battles broke out as ships once belonging to the presumably defunct Martian war machine came out of hiding in the distant Kuiper Belt and began a series of hit-and-run attacks on the Pax fleet convoys in old Earth system. The kill ratio in these attacks was 5-1 in favor of Pax fleet, but the losses were unacceptable and the cost of maintaining the Mars operation was frightful.
Admiral Maryusin and the Joint Chiefs advised His Holiness to cut his losses and leave Old Earth System to fester for the time being. The Admiral assured the Pope that nothing would be allowed out of the system. He pointed out that there was nothing of real value in Old Earth System any longer, now that Mars was untenable. The Pope listened but refused to authorize the pullout. At each conference, Cardinal Lourdesami stressed the symbolic importance of keeping Old Earth System within the Pax. His Holiness decided to wait to make his decision. The hemorrhage of ships, men, money, and materiel went on. On Mare Infinitus, the rebellion was old, based around the submarine smugglers, poachers, and those hundreds of thousands of stubborn indigenes who had always refused the cross, but stirred up anew now that the Anea contagion had arrived. The great fishing zones were now all but off-limits to unescorted Pax fishing fleets. The automated fishing ships and isolated floating platforms were attacked and sunk. More and more of the deadly lantern-mouth monsters were seen in shallower waters, and Archbishop Jane Kelly was furious at the Pax authorities for their failure to stop the problem. When Bishop Melandriano counseled moderation, Kelly had him excommunicated. In turn, Melandriano declared the Southern Seas seceded from the Pax and Church's authority, and thousands of the faithful followed the charismatic leader. The Vatican sent more Pax fleet ships, but there was little they could do to settle the four-way surface and subsurface struggles between the rebels, the Archbishop's forces, the Bishop's forces, and the Lantern Mouths. And in the midst of all this confusion and carnage, Aeneas' message traveled with the speed of speech and secret communion. Rebellion, both violent and spiritual, flared elsewhere. The worlds where Aeneas had traveled, Ixion, Patotha, Amritsar, and Groombridge Dyson D. On Tsingtao Siswang Pana, where word of the roundup of non-Christians elsewhere created first panic and then grim resistance to all things Pax. On Deneb Dre, where the Jamnu Republic declared the wearing of a cruciform cause for beheading. On Fuji, where Aeneas' message had been brought by renegade members of the Pax Mercantilis, and where it spread like a planetary firestorm. On the desert world of Vitus Grey Balianus B, where Aeneas' teachings came via refugees from Sibiatu's bitterness, and combined with the realization that the Pax way of life would destroy their culture forever. The Amoyeti Spectrum Helix people led the fight. The city of Koroa Tambat was liberated in the first month of fighting, and Pax base Bombasino soon became a fortress under siege. Base commander Solznikov screamed for help from Pax fleet, but the Vatican and Pax fleet commanders, preoccupied elsewhere, ordered him to be patient and threatened excommunication if Solznikov did not end the rebellion on his own. Solznikov did so, but not in the way Pax fleet or His Holiness would have countenanced. He arranged for a peace treaty with the Amoyeti Spectrum Helix armies, in which his Pax forces would enter the countryside only with the permission of the indigenes. In return, Pax base Bombasino was allowed to continue its existence. Solznikov, Colonel Venara, and the other loyal Christians settled in to wait for Vatican and Pax fleet retribution. But the Aeneas-changed civilians were among the Spectrum Helix people who came to market at Bombasino, who met and ate and drank with the troopers, who moved among the dispirited Pax men and women and told their story, and who offered their communion. Many accepted. This, of course, was the tiniest slice of events on the hundreds of worlds of the Pax that last sad night I would ever spend on Tian Shan. I did not guess any of these events, of course, but if I had already mastered the skill and discipline of learning these things via the void which binds, I still would not have cared. Aeneas had loved another man. They had been married. She must still be married. She had not mentioned divorce or death. She had had a child. I do not know why my carelessness did not send me falling to my death those wild hours on the icy ridge east of Zhou Kong and Swan Kung Su, but it did not. Eventually I came to my senses and returned via the ridgeline and the fixed rappelling ropes so that I could be back with Aeneas by first light. I loved her. She was my dear friend.
I would give my life to protect her. An opportunity to prove that would be offered within the day, its inevitability created by the events that unfolded shortly after my return to the temple hanging in air, and our departure to the east. It was not that long after first light, in the old Gompa beneath the phallus Shiva now turned into Christian enclave, where John Domenico Cardinal Mustafa, Admiral Margaret Wu, Father Farrell, Archbishop Breck, Father LeBlanc, Radamanth Nemes, and her two remaining siblings met in conference. In truth, it was the humans who met in conference, while Nemes and her clone sister and brother sat silently by the window, looking out over the billowing cloudscapes around Otter Lake, below the Shivling Peak. "And you are certain that the rogue ship Raphael is finished?" the Grand Inquisitor was saying. "Absolutely," said Admiral Wu, "although it destroyed 7 of our Archangel ships of the line before we slacked it." She shook her head. DeSoya was a brilliant tactician. It was the true work of the Evil One when he turned apostate. Father Farrell leaned over the polished bonsai wood table. "And there is no chance that DeSoya or any of the others survived?" Admiral Wu shrugged. "It was a near-orbit battle," she said. "We let Raphael get within cislunar distance before springing our trap. Thousands of pieces of debris, mostly from our unfortunate ships, entered the atmosphere. None of our people appeared to have survived. At least no beacons have been detected. If any of DeSoya's people escaped, the chances are that their pods came down in the poisonous oceans."
"Still,"
began Archbishop Breck. He was a quiet man, cerebral and cautious. Wu looked exhausted and irritated. "Your Eminence," she said briskly, addressing Breck but looking at Mustafa. "We can decide the issue one way or the other if you allow us to send dropships, skimmers, and EMVs into the atmosphere." Breck blinked. Cardinal Mustafa shook his head. "No," he said. "Our orders are not to show a military presence until the Vatican commands the final step in our seizure of the girl." Wu smiled with apparent bitterness. "Last night's battle just above the atmosphere must have made that order somewhat obsolete," she said softly. "Our military presence must have been rather impressive." "It was," said Father LeBlanc. "I have never seen anything like it." Admiral Wu spoke to Mustafa. "Your Excellency, the people on this world have no energy weapons, no Hawking drive detectors, no orbital defenses, no gravitonic detectors. Hell, they don't have radar or a communications system as far as we can tell. We can send dropships or fighter aircraft into the atmosphere to search for survivors without them ever knowing. It has to be a lot less intrusive than last night's firefight and..."
"No," said Cardinal Mustafa, and there was no doubting the finality of his decision. The Grand Inquisitor pushed back his robe to glance at his chronometer. "The Vatican courier drone should arrive any moment with final orders for the arrest of the contagion vector named Anea. Nothing must complicate that." Father Farrell rubbed his lean cheeks.
"Regent Tok'ra called me this morning on the communicator channel we allocated him. It seems that their precious and precocious little Dalai Lama has gone missing." Breck and LeBlanc looked up in surprise.
"It doesn't matter," said Cardinal Mustafa, obviously aware of the news. "Nothing matters right now except receiving final go-ahead on this mission and arresting Anea." He looked at Admiral Wu. "And you must tell your Swiss Guard and Marine officers that no harm can come to the young woman." Wu nodded wearily. She had been briefed and rebriefed for months.
"When do you think that the orders will come?" she asked the Cardinal. Radamanth Nemes and her two siblings stood and walked toward the door.
"The time for waiting is over," said Nemes with a thin-lipped smile. "We will bring Anea's head back to you."
Cardinal Mustafa and the others were on their feet in an instant.
"Sit down," bellowed the Grand Inquisitor. "You have not been ordered to move."
Nemes smiled and turned toward the door. All of the clerics in the room were shouting. Archbishop Jean-Daniel Breck crossed himself. Admiral Wu went for the flechette pistol in her holster.
Things then happened too quickly to perceive. The air seemed to blur. One instant, Nemes, Scylla, and Briareus were at the doorway 8 meters away. The next instant, they were gone, and 3 shimmering chrome shapes stood among the black and red-robed figures at the table. Scylla intercepted Admiral Margit Wu before the woman could raise her flechet pistol. A chrome arm blurred. Wu's head tumbled across the polished tabletop. The headless body stood a few seconds. Some random nerve impulse ordered the fingers of the right hand to close, and the flechet pistol fired, blowing apart the legs of the heavy table and splintering the stone floor in 10,000 places. Father LeBlanc leaped between Briareus and Archbishop Breck. The blurred silver shape disemboweled LeBlanc. Breck dropped his glasses and ran into the adjoining room. Suddenly, Briareus was gone, leaving nothing but a soft implosion of air where the blurred shape had stood a second before. There was a short scream from the other room, cut off almost before it began. Cardinal Mustafa backed away from Radamanth Nemes. She took one step forward for every step he took backward. The blurred field around her had dropped away, but she looked no more human or less menacing.
"Damn you for the foul thing you are!" the cardinal said softly. "Come ahead, I'm not afraid to die."
Nemes raised one eyebrow.
"Of course not, Your Excellency. But would it change your mind if I tell you that we're throwing these bodies? And that head?"
She gestured to where Margit Wu's eyes had just stopped blinking and now stared blindly.
"Far out into the acid ocean, so that no resurrection will be possible?"
Cardinal Mustafa reached the wall and stopped. Nemes was only 2 paces in front of him.
"Why are you doing this?"
he said, his voice firm. Nemes shrugged.
"Our priorities diverge for the time being," she said. "Are you ready, Grand Inquisitor?"
Cardinal Mustafa crossed himself and said a hurried act of contrition. Nemes smiled again. Her right arm and right leg became shimmering silver things, and she stepped forward. Mustafa watched in amazement. She did not kill him. With motions too quick to detect, she broke his left arm, shattered his right arm, kicked his legs out from under him, splintering both of them, and blinded him with 2 fingers that stopped just short of jabbing into his brain. The roar of pain was without precedent for the Grand Inquisitor. Through it, he could hear her voice, still flat and lifeless.
"I know your dock in the box in the dropship or on the Jibril will fix you up," she said. "We've buzzed them. They'll be here in a few minutes. When you see the Pope and his parasites, tell them that those to whom I must report did not want the girl alive. Our apologies, but her death is necessary. And tell them to be careful in the future, not to act without the consent of all elements of the Corps. Goodbye, Your Excellency. I hope that the dock on the Jibril can grow you new eyes. What we are about to do will be worth seeing."
Mustafa heard footsteps, the door sliding and then silence, except for the sound of someone screaming in terrible pain. It took him several minutes to realize that it was he who was screaming. When I returned to the temple hanging in air, first light was seeping through the fog, but the morning remained dark, drizzly, and cold. I had finally sobered up enough from my distraught and distracted state to take greater care while rappelling down the fixed lines. And it was good that I had. Several times the brakes on the rappel gear slipped on the ice-shrouded rope, and I would have fallen to my death if the safety lines had not arrested me. Anea was awake, dressed, and ready to leave when I arrived. She had on her thermal anorak, climbing harness, and climbing boots. A. Betic and Lomo Dondrub were dressed similarly, and both men carried long, heavy-looking nylon-wrapped packages over their shoulders. They were going with us. Others were there to say goodbye. Theo, Rachel, the Dorji Famo, the Dalai Lama, George Sarong, Jigme Norbu. And they seemed sad and anxious. Anea looked tired. I was sure that she had not slept either. We made a tired-looking pair of adventurers. Lomo walked over and handed me one of the long nylon-wrapped bundles. It was heavy, but I shouldered it without question or complaint.
I grabbed the rest of my own gear, answered Lomo's questions about the condition of the ropes to the ridgeline. Everyone evidently thought that I had unselfishly reconnoitered our route, and stepped back to look at my friend and beloved. When she gave me a searching look, I answered with a nod. It's all right. I'm all right. I'm ready to go. We'll talk about it later. Thea was crying. I was aware that this was an important parting, that we might not see one another again, despite Aenea's assurances to the other two women that everyone would be reunited before nightfall. But I was too emotionally numbed and worn out to react to it. I stepped away from the group for a moment to take deep breaths and focus my attention. It was probable that I would need all of my wits and alertness in the next few hours just to survive. The problem with being passionately in love, I thought, is that it deprives you of too much sleep. We left by the east platform, moved in a fast trot down the icy ledge toward the fissure, past the ropes I just descended, and reached the fissure without incident. The bonsai trees and fell fields looked ancient and unreal in the shifting ice fog, the dark limbs and branches dripping on our heads when they suddenly loomed out of the mist. The streams and waterfalls sounded louder than I remembered as the torrent slid over the last overhang into the void to our left. There were old, less reliable fixed ropes on the easternmost and highest folds of the fissure, and Lomo led the way up these, followed by Aenea, then Abetic, and finally me. I noticed that our android friend was climbing as quickly and competently as he always did, despite the missing left hand. Once on the upper ridgeline, we were beyond my farthest point of my nighttime travels. The fissure acted as a barrier to ridgeline travel the way I had gone. Now the difficulty began in earnest as we followed the narrowest of paths, worn ledges, rock outcroppings, the occasional ice field, scree slopes, on the south side of the cliff face. The ridgeline above us was all serac of wet, heavy snow and icy overhang, impossible to travel on. We moved silently, not even whispering, aware that the slightest noise could trigger an avalanche that would sweep us off these 10-centimeter ledges in a second. Finally, when the going got even tougher, we roped up, running the line through carabiners and attaching a doubled line to our web-sling harnesses, so that now, if one fell, he or she would be caught, or we would all go over. With Lomo leading as strongly as ever, stepping confidently over foggy voids and icy crevasses that I would hesitate to attempt, I think that we all felt better about being connected. I still did not know our destination. I did know that the great ridge that ran east from Kunlun past Zhou Kung would run out in a few more kilometers, dropping suddenly and dramatically into the poisonous clouds several clicks below. During certain weeks in the spring, the tides and vagaries of the ocean and clouds dropped the poisonous vapors low enough that the ridge emerged again, allowing supply caravans, pilgrims, monks, traders, and the simply curious to make their way east from the Middle Kingdom to Tai Shan, the great peak of the Middle Kingdom, and the most inaccessible habitable point on the planet. The monks who lived on Tai Shan, it was said, never returned to the Middle Kingdom or the rest of the Mountains of Heaven. For untold generations they had dedicated their lives to the mysterious tombs, gompas, ceremonies, and temples on that most holy of peaks. Now, as the weather worsened for us, I realized that if we started descending, we would not know when we left the roiling monsoon clouds and entered the roiling vaporous clouds until the poison air killed us. We did not descend. After several hours of all but silent travel, we reached the precipice at the eastern boundary of the Middle Kingdom. The mountain of Tai Shan was not visible, of course. Even with the clouds having cleared a bit, little was visible except for the wet cliff face ahead of us and the twisting fog and cloud patterns all around. There was a wide ledge here at the eastern edge of the world, and we sat on it gratefully as we dug cold hand meals out of our packs and drank from our water bottles. The tiny, succulent plants that carpeted this steep fell field were becoming tumescent as they gorged themselves on the first moisture of the monsoon months. After we ate and drank, Lomo and Abetic began opening our three heavy bundles,
Anea zipped open her own pack, which looked heavier than the duffels we men had carried. It did not surprise me what was wrapped in these three parcels. Nylon, alloy struts and frames, rigging, and in Anea's packet, more of the same, as well as the two skin suits and rebreathers that I'd brought with me from the ship and all but forgotten. I sighed and looked to the east.
"So we're going to try to make Taishan," I said.
"Yes," said Anea. She began stripping out of her clothes. Abedic and Lomo looked away, but I felt my heart pound with anger at the thought of other men seeing my lover naked. I controlled myself, laid out the other skin suit, and began peeling out of my own clothes, folding them into my heavy pack as I doffed each layer. The air was cold and the fog clammy on my skin. Lomo and Abedic were assembling the para-wings as Anea and I dressed. The skin suits were just that, almost literally a second skin. But the harness and rigging for the rebreathers allowed us some modesty. The cowl went over my head tighter than a scuba headpiece, folding my ears flat against my head. Only the filters there allowed sound to be transmitted. They would pick up the comm thread transmissions once we were effectively out of real air. Lomo and Abedic had reassembled four para-wings from the parts we had transported. As if answering my unasked question, Lomo said,
"I can only show you the thermals and make sure you reach the jet stream. I can't survive at that altitude. And I do not want to go to Taishan when there is little chance of returning."
Anea touched the powerful man's arm. "We are grateful beyond words that you will guide us to the jet stream." The bold flyer actually blushed.
"What about Abedic?" I asked, and then, realizing that I was talking about our friend as if he weren't there, I turned to the android and said, "What about you? There's no skin suit or rebreather for you."
Abedic smiled. I had always thought that his rare smiles were the wisest things I had ever seen on a human countenance, even if the blue-skinned man was not technically human.
"You forget, Emendymion," he said. "I was designed to suffer a bit more abuse than the average human body."
"But the distance," I began. "Taishan was more than 100 kilometers east, and even if we reached the jet stream, that would be almost an hour of rarefied air, far too thin to breathe." Abedic fastened the last rigging to his para-wing, a pretty thing with a great blue delta wingspan almost 10 meters across, and said,
"If we are lucky enough to make the distance, I will survive it."
I nodded, and made to get into the rigging of my own kite then, not asking any more questions, not looking at Anea, not asking her why the four of us were risking our lives this way, when suddenly my friend was at my elbow.
"Thank you, Rol," she said, loudly enough for all to hear. "You do these things for me out of love and friendship. I thank you. From the bottom of my heart."
I made some gesture, suddenly unable to speak, embarrassed that she was thanking me when the other two were ready to leap into the void for her as well. But she was not finished speaking.
"I love you, Rol," said Anea, leaning on her tiptoes to kiss me on the lips. She rocked back and looked at me, her dark eyes fathomless. "I love you, Rol Endymion. I always have. I always will."
I stood, bewildered and overwhelmed, as we all locked into our para-wing rigs and stood at the ultimate edge of nothing. Lomo was the last to clip on. He moved from Abedic to Anea to me, checking our riggings, checking every fastened nut, bolt, tension clip, and insta-weld of our kites. Satisfied, he nodded respectfully toward Abedic, clipped into his own red-winged rig with a speed born of infinite practice and discipline, and moved to the edge of the cliff. Even the succulents did not grow in this last meter stretch, as if terrified of the drop. I knew that I was. The last rocky ledge was steeply pitched and slick from the rain. The fog had closed in again.
"It will be hard to see each other in this soup," said Lomo. "Keep circling to the left. Stay within 5 meters of the one in front of you. Same orders as our march. Anea after me and your yellow wing, then the blue man in blue, then you, Rol, in the green. Our greatest risk is losing one another in the clouds."
Aenea nodded tersely.
I'll stay close to your wing.
Lomo looked at me.
You and Aenea can communicate via your skin suit comm threads, but that will not help you find one another. Abetic and I will communicate via hand signals. Be careful. Do not lose sight of the blue man's kite. If you do, keep circling up counterclockwise until you clear the cloud tops and then try to regroup with us. Keep the circles tight while inside the clouds. If you loosen them, which is the tendency with parawings, you will strike the cliff.
My mouth was dry as I nodded.
All right, said Lomo. I will see you all above the clouds. Then I will find the thermals for you, read the ridge lift, and get you to the jet stream. I will signal like this.
He made a fist and pumped his arm twice.
When I am leaving you, keep climbing and circling. Get as deeply into the stream as you can. Rise into the upper atmospheric winds until you think that they will tear your wing apart from above you. Perhaps they will, but you will have no chance to reach Taishan unless you get into the center of the stream. It is 111 clicks to the first shoulder of the Great Peak, where you can breathe true air.
We all nodded.
May the Buddha smile on our folly today, said Lomo.
He seemed very happy.
Amen, said Aenea.
Lomo turned without another word and leaped out over the cliff's edge. Aenea followed a second later. Abetic leaned far forward in his harness, kicked off the ledge, and was swallowed up by clouds within seconds. I scurried to catch up. Suddenly, there was no stone under my feet, and I leaned forward until I was prone in the harness. Already I had lost sight of Abetic's blue wing. The swirling clouds confused and disoriented me. I pulled on the control bar, banking the hang glider as I had been taught, peering intently through the fog for a glimpse of any of the other kites. Nothing. Belatedly, I realized that I had held the turn for too long. Or had I released it too soon? I leveled off the wing, feeling thermals pushing at the fabric above me, but not being able to tell if I was actually gaining altitude because I was blind. The fog was like some terrible snow blindness. Without thinking, I shouted, hoping one of the others would shout back and orient me. A man's shout hurtled back to me from just a few meters dead ahead. It was my own voice, echoing off the vertical rock of the cliff face I was about to strike. Nemes, Scylla, and Briareus move south on foot from the Pax enclave at the phallus of Shiva. The sun is high and there are thick clouds to the east. To travel from the Pax enclave to the Winter Palace at Potala, the old highway southwest along the Kokonor Ridge had been repaired and widened, and a special cable platform had been built where the 10-click wire ran from Kokonor southwest to the palace. A palanquin specially rigged for the Pax diplomats now hangs from pulleys at the new platform. Nemes pushes to the front of the line and steps into it, ignoring the stares from the little people in thick jubas who mill on the stairway and platform. When her clone siblings are in the cage, she releases the two brakes and sends the palanquin hurtling across the gap. Dark clouds rise above the palace mountain. A squad of 20 palace guard carrying halberds and crude energy lances greets them at the great terrace steps on the west side of Yellow Hat Ridge, where the palace drops away down the east face for several vertical kilometers. The captain of the guard is deferential.
You must wait here until we bring an honor guard to escort you into the palace, most honored guests, he says, bowing.
We prefer to go in alone, says Nemes. The 20 guardsmen crouch, with lances at port arms. They make a solid wall of iron, zygote fur, silk, and elaborate helmets. The guard captain bows lower.
I apologize for my unworthiness, most honored guests, but it is not possible to enter the Winter Palace without an invitation and an honor guard. Both will be here in a minute. If you will be so kind as to wait in the shade under the pagoda roof here, honored guests, a personage of the proper rank to greet you will arrive in only a moment.
Nemes nods.
Kill them, she says to Scylla and Briareus, and walks forward into the palace as her siblings' phase shift.
They shift down during the long walk through the many leveled palace, shifting into fast time only to kill guards and servants. When they exit by the main steps and approach the Pargo Kaling, the great western gate on this side of the Ki Chu Bridge, they find Regent Retting Tokra blocking the way with 500 of his finest palace guard troops. A few of these elite fighters carry swords and pikes, but most hold crossbows, slug rifles, crude energy weapons, and railguns.
"Commander Nemes," says Tokra, lowering his head slightly, but not bowing so much as to lose eye contact with the woman in front of him. "We have heard what you did at Shivling. You can go no farther."
Tokra nods at someone high up in the gleaming eyes on the Pargo Kaling Tower, and the black chrome bridge of Ki Chu slides silently back into the mountain. Only the great suspension cables remain far above, ringed about with razor wire and frictionless gel. Nemes smiles.
"What are you doing, Tokra?" "His Holiness has gone to Swan Kung Su," says the thin-faced regent. "I know why you travel that way. You cannot be allowed to harm His Holiness the Dalai Lama."
Radamanth Nemeth shows more of her small teeth.
"What are you talking about, Tokra? You sold out your dear little boy god to the Pak Secret Service for 30 pieces of silver. Are we bartering here for more of your stupid six-sided coins?"
The regent shakes his head.
"The agreement with the Pax was that His Holiness would never be hurt, but you..."
"We want the girl's head," says Nemes, "not your boy Lama's. Get your men out of our way or lose them." Regent Tokra turns and barks an order at his row upon row of soldiers. The men's faces are grim as they raise their weapons to their shoulders. The mass of them blocks the way to the bridge, even though the roadway of the bridge is no longer there. Dark clouds boil in the chasm.
"Kill them all," says Nemes, phase shifting.
Lomo had trained us all in the hang glider controls, but I had never had the opportunity to fly one before. Now, as the cliff rose out of the fog in front of me, I had to do the correct thing immediately, or die. The kite was controlled by manipulating the control bar that hung in front of me as I dangled in my harness, and I leaned as far left and put as much weight on it as the rigging allowed. The parawing banked, but not steeply enough, I realized at once. The kite was going to intercept the rock wall a meter or two away from the outer apex of its arc. There was another set of controls, handle grips that spilled air from the dorsal surface at the leading edge of each side of the dorsal wing. But these were dangerous and tricky and for emergency use only. I could see the lichen on the approaching rock wall. This was an emergency. I pulled hard on the left panic handle. The nylon on the left side of the para wing opened like a slit purse. The right wing, still catching the strong ridge lift here, banked up steeply. The para wing turned almost upside down, with its useless left wing spilling air like so much empty aluminum frame. My legs were flung out sideways as the kite threatened to stall and plummet into the rocks. My boots actually brushed stone and lichen, and then the wing was falling almost straight down. I released the left handle. The active memory fabric on the left leading surface healed itself in an instant, and I was flying again, although in a near vertical dive. The strong thermals rising along the cliff face struck the kite like a rising elevator, and I was slammed upward, the control bar swinging back against my upper chest hard enough to knock the wind out of me, and the parawing swooped, climbed, and tried to do a lazy loop with a radius of 60 or 70 meters. I found myself hanging almost upside down again, but this time with the kite and controls beneath me and the rock wall dead ahead again. This was no good. I would conclude the loop on the cliff wall. I yanked the right panic handle, spilled lift, tumbled sideways in a sickening drop, sealed the wing and tugged handles and control bar while shifting my weight wildly to establish balance and control. The clouds had parted enough for me to see the cliff 20 or 30 meters to my right as I fought the thermals and the kite itself for a clean line. Then I was leveled and flying the contraption.
spiraling around to my left again, but carefully this time, ever so carefully, thankful for the break in the clouds that allowed me to judge my distance from the cliff and leaning hard left on the control bar. Suddenly, a whisper in my ear said, "Wow, that was fun to watch. Do it again." I jumped at the voice in my ear and then looked up and behind me. The bright yellow triangle of Aenea's parawing circled above me, the clouds close above it like a gray ceiling. "No thanks," I said, allowing the calm threads on the throat of my skin suit to pick up the sub-vocals. "I guess I'm through showing off." I glanced up at her again. "Why are you here? Where's Abetic?"
"We rendezvoused above the clouds. Didn't see you, and I came down to find you,"
Aenea said simply, her calm-threaded voice soft in my ear. I felt a surge of nausea, more from the thought of her risking everything to do that than from the violent acrobatics of a moment earlier. "I'm all right," I said gruffly. "Just had to get the feel of the ridge lift."
"Yeah," said Aenea. "It's tricky. Why don't you follow me up?"
I did so, not allowing my pride to get in the way of survival. It was difficult to keep her yellow wing in sight with the shifting fog, but easier than flying blind near this cliff. She seemed to sense exactly where the rock wall was, cutting our circle within 5 meters of it, catching the strong center of the thermals there, but never coming too close or swinging too wide. Within minutes, we came out of the clouds. I admit that the experience took my breath away. First, a slow brightening, then a rush of sunlight, then rising above the cloud level like a swimmer emerging from a white sea, then squinting into the bright light within the blinding freedom of blue sky and a seemingly infinite view on all sides. Only the highest peaks and ridgelines were visible above the ocean of clouds. Tai Shan gleaming cold and icy white so far to our east, Heng Shan about equidistant to the north, our ridgeline from Zhou Kung rising like a razor's edge just above the tides of cloud running back to the west, Kunlun Ridge a distant wall running northwest to southeast, and far, far away near the edge of the world, the brilliant summits of Chomo Lori, Mount Parnassus, Kangchung Junga, Mount Koya, Mount Calais, and others I could not identify from this angle. There was a glimmer of sunlight on something tall beyond distant Fari Ridge, and I thought this might be the Botala or the lesser Shivling. I quit gawking and turned my attention back to our attempt to gain altitude. Abetic circled close by and gave me a thumbs up. I returned the signal and looked up to see Lomo gesturing 50 meters above us. "Close up! Keep your circles tight! Follow me!" We did that, Aenea easily climbing to her wingman position behind Lomo, Abetic's blue kite circling across the climb circle from her, and me bringing up the rear 15 meters below and 50 meters across the circle from the android. Lomo seemed to know exactly where the thermals were. Sometimes we circled farther back west, caught the lift, and opened our circles to move east again. Sometimes we seemed to circle without gaining altitude, but then I would look north to Heng Shan and sense that we had covered another several hundred meters upward. Slowly we climbed and slowly we circled east, although Tai Shan must still have been 80 or 90 clicks away. It grew colder and harder to breathe. I sealed the last bit of osmosis mask and inhaled pure O2 as we climbed. The skin suit tightened around me, acting as a pressure suit and therm suit all in one. I could see Lomo shivering in his zygote chuba and heavy mittens. There was ice on Abetic's bare forearm, and still we circled and rose. The sky darkened and the view grew more unbelievable. Distant Nanda Devi in the southwest, Helgafell in the even more distant southeast, and Harney Peak far beyond the Shivling, all coming into sight above the curve of the planet. Finally, Lomo had had enough. A moment earlier, I had unsealed the clear osmosis mask on my hood to see how thick the air was, tried to inhale what felt like hard vacuum, and quickly resealed the membrane. I could not imagine how Lomo managed to breathe, think, and function at this altitude.
Now he signaled us to keep circling higher on the thermal he had been working, gave us the ancient good luck sign of the circled thumb and forefinger, and then spilled the thin air out of his delta kite to drop away like a hurtling Thomas Hawk. Within seconds, the red delta was several thousand meters below us and swooping toward the ridgeline to the west. We continued circling and climbing, occasionally losing the lift for a moment, but then finding it again. We were being blown eastward by the lower edges of the jet stream, but we followed Lomo's final advice and resisted the temptation to turn toward our destination. We did not have enough altitude or tailwind yet to make the 80-kilometer voyage. Encountering the jet stream was like suddenly entering a whitewater rapids in a kayak. Aenea's kite found the edge of it first, and I watched the yellow fabric vibrate as if in a powerful gale, then the aluminum superstructure flex wildly. Then Abetic and I were into it, and it was everything we could do to hold ourselves horizontal in the swinging harness behind the control bar and continue circling for altitude. "It's hard," came Aenea's voice in my ear. "It wants to tear loose and head east." "We can't," I gasped, pulling the power wing into the headwind again and being thrown higher in one great vertical lift ride.
"I know," came Aenea's strained voice. I was 100 meters away and below her now, but I could see her small form wrestling with the control bar, her legs straight, her small feet pointed backward like a cliff diver's. I peered around. The brilliant sun was haloed by ice crystals. The ridge lines were almost invisible so far below. The summits of the highest peaks now clicks beneath us.
"How is Abetic doing?" asked Aenea. I twisted and strained to see. The android was circling above me. His eyes appeared to be closed, but I could see him making adjustments to the control bar. His blue flesh gleamed with frost.
"All right, I think," I said. "Aenea?"
"Yes?"
"Is there any chance of the Pax at Shivling or in orbit picking up our comm-thread broadcasts?"
The comm unit diskey journal was in my pocket, but we had decided never to use it until it was time to call the ship. It would be ironic if we were captured or killed because of using these skin-suit communicators.
"No chance," gasped Aenea.
Even with the osmosis masks and the rebreather matrix woven into the skin suits, the air was thin and cold.
"The comm threads are very short range, half a click at most."
"Then stay close," I said, and concentrated on gaining a few hundred more meters before the almost silent hurricane that was buffeting me sent the kite screaming off to the east. Another few minutes, and we could no longer resist the powerful current in this river of air. The thermal did not lessen. It just seemed to die away completely. And then we were at the mercy of the jet stream.
"Let's go!" shouted Aenea,
forgetting that her slightest whisper was audible in my ear patch. I could see Abetic open his eyes and give me a thumbs up. At the same instant, my own power wing peeled off the thermal and was swept away to the east. Even with the diminished sound, we seemed to be roaring through the air at a speed so incredible that it was audible. Aenea's yellow delta streaked east like a crossbow dart. Abetic's blue followed. I wrestled with the controls, realized that I did not have the strength to change course 1 degree, and simply held on while we rifled east and down in the pounding, flowing river of air. Tai Shan gleamed ahead of us, but we were losing altitude quickly now, and the mountain was still very far away. Kilometers beneath us, beneath the monsoon sea of white cloud tops, the greenish phosgene clouds of the acid world ocean churned away, unseen, but waiting. The Pax authorities in Tian Shan's system were confused. When Captain Womack and the Jibril received the strange pulsed alarm signal from the Pax enclave at Shivling, he tried hailing Cardinal Mustafa and the others, but received no answer. Within minutes he had dispatched a combat dropship with 2 dozen Pax Marines, including 3 medics. The Tightline report uplink was confusing. The conference room at their enclave Gompa was a gory mess. Human blood and viscera were splashed everywhere.
but the only body remaining was that of the Grand Inquisitor, who had been crippled and blinded. They DNA-typed the largest arterial spray and found it to be that of Father Farrell. Other pools of blood reportedly belonged to Archbishop Breck and his aide, LeBlanc. But no bodies, no cruciforms. The medics reported that Cardinal Mustafa was comatose, in deep shock, and near death. They stabilized him as best they could, using only their field kits, and asked for orders. Should they let the Grand Inquisitor die and be resurrected, or get him to the dropship dock in the box and try to save him, knowing that it would be several days before he could regain consciousness and describe the attack? Or the medic could get him to life support, use drugs to bring the Cardinal out of the coma, and interrogate him within minutes, all the while with the patient under exquisite pain and on the verge of death. Womack ordered them to wait and tight-beamed Admiral Lamprière, the task force commander. Out in the Tian Shan system, many AUs distant, the 40-some ships that had come through the battle with Raphael were rescuing survivors from the terminally damaged Archangels and awaiting the arrival of the Papal drone and the Technocore robot ship that would be putting the planet's population in suspended animation. Neither had arrived. Lamprière was closer, 4 light minutes away, and the tight beam would take that long to reach him and bring him up to speed. But Womack felt he had no other choice. He waited while his message burned out system. Aboard the flagship Rogwell, Lamprière found himself in a ticklish situation, with only minutes to decide about Mustafa. If he allowed the Grand Inquisitor to die, it was likely that a 2-day resurrection would be successful. The Cardinal would suffer little pain. But the cause of the attack, Shrike, Indigenes, the Aenea Monster's disciples, Ousters, might remain a mystery until then. Lamprière took 10 seconds to decide, but it was a 4-minute tight-beam delay out and back.
"Have the medic stabilize him," he tight-beamed Womack on the Jabril in orbit around the mountain planet. "Get him to dropship life support. Bring him out of it, interrogate him. When we know enough, have the auto-surgeon give a prognosis. If it's faster to resurrect him, let him die."
"Aye, aye, sir," said Womack 4 minutes later and passed word along to the Marines. Meanwhile, the Marines were widening their search, using EMV reaction packs to search the vertical cliffsides around the phallus of Shiva. They deep-radared Ran So, the so-called Otter Lake, finding neither otters nor the bodies of the missing priests. There had been an honor guard of 12 Marines in the enclave with the Grand Inquisitor's party, plus the pilot of the dropship. But these men and women were also missing. Blood and viscera were found and DNA typed, most of the missing thus accounted for, but their bodies were not found.
"Shall we spread the search to the Winter Palace?" questioned the Marine lieutenant in charge of the party.
All of the Marines had specific orders not to disturb the locals, especially the Dalai Lama and his people, before the Technocore ship arrived to put the population asleep.
"Just a minute," said Womack.
He saw that Admiral Lamprière's monitor telltale was on. The comm disk key on his command web was also blinking. Jabril's intelligence officer, down in the sensor bubble.
"Yes?"
"Captain, we've been visually monitoring the palace area. Something terrible has happened there."
"What?" snapped Womack. It was not like any member of his crew to be so vague.
"We missed it, sir," said the intel officer.
She was a young woman, but smart, Lamprière knew.
"We were using the optics to check the area around the enclave, but look at this."
Womack turned his head slightly to watch the hollow pit fill with an image, knowing that it was being tight-beamed out to the Admiral. The east side of the Winter Palace, Potala, as if seen from a few hundred meters above the Kiichu Bridge. The roadway of the bridge was gone, retracted. But on the steps and terraces between the palace and the bridge, and on some of the narrow ledges in the chasm between the palace and the Daeprung Monastery on the east side, were scores of bodies, hundreds of bodies, bloodied and dismembered.
"Dear Lord," said Captain Womack and crossed himself.
"We've identified the head of Regent Tok'ra Redding there among the body parts," came the intel officer's calm voice.
"The head?" repeated Womack, realizing that his useless remark was being sent to the Admiral along with all the rest of this transmission.
In 4 minutes, Admiral Lamprière would know that Womack made stupid comments.
No matter. Anyone else important there?
He queried intel.
Negative, sir, came the young officer's voice. But they're broadcasting on various radio frequencies now.
Walmack raised an eyebrow. So far, the Winter Palace had maintained radio and tight-beam silence.
What are they saying?
It's in Mandarin and post-Hegira Tibetan, sir, said the officer. But then quickly.
They're in a panic, Captain. The Dalai Lama is missing. So is the head of the Boy Lama's security team. General Sirkang Siwang Chempo, leader of the palace guard, is dead, sir. They've confirmed that his headless body was found there.
Walmack glanced at the clock. The tight-beam broadcast was halfway to the Admiral's ship.
Who did this intel? The Shrike?
Don't know, sir. As I said, the lenses and cameras were elsewhere. We'll check the disks.
Do that, said Walmack.
He could not wait any longer. He tight-beamed the Marine Lieutenant.
Get to the palace, Lieutenant. See what the hell is going on. I'm sending down 5 more dropships, combat EMVs, and a Thopter gunship. Search for any sign of Archbishop Breck, Father Farrell, or Father LeBlanc. And the pilot and honor guard, of course.
Aye, aye, sir.
The tight-beam link went green. The Admiral was receiving the latest transmission. Too late to wait for his command. Walmack tight-beamed the 2 closest pack ships, torch ships just beyond the outer moon, and ordered them on battle alert and to drop into matching orbit with the Jibril. He might need the firepower. Walmack had seen the Shrike's work before, and the thought of that creature suddenly appearing on his ship made his skin go cold. He tight-beamed Captain Samuels on the torch ship HHS St. Bonaventure.
Carol, he said to the startled captain's image. Go tactical space, please.
Walmack jacked in and was standing in place above the gleaming cloud planet of Tian Shan. Samuels suddenly appeared next to him in the starry darkness.
Carol, said Walmack, something's going on down there. I think the Shrike may be loose again. If you suddenly lose transmission data from the Jibril, or we start screaming gibberish.
I launch 3 boats of Marines, said Samuels.
Negative, said Walmack. Slag the Jibril immediately.
Captain Samuels blinked. So did the floating telltale that showed that Admiral Lampriere's flagship was tight-beaming. Walmack jacked out of tactical. The message was short.
I've spun the Raguil up for a jump in-system to just beyond the critical gravity well around Tian Shan, said Admiral Lampriere, his thin face grave.
Walmack opened his mouth to protest to his superior, realized that a tight-beamed protest would arrive almost 3 minutes after the Hawking Drive jump was executed, and shut his mouth. A jump in-system like this was sickeningly dangerous, 1 chance in 4 at least of a disaster that would claim all hands. But he understood the Admiral's need to get to where the information was fresh and his commands could be executed immediately.
Dear Jesus, thought Walmack. The Grand Inquisitor crippled, the Archbishop and the others missing, the sodding Dalai Lama's palace looking like an anthill that's been kicked over. God damn that Shrike thing. Where's the papal courier probe with its command? Where's that core ship we were promised? How can things get worse than this?
Captain?
It was the chief marine medic on the expeditionary force, beaming from the dropship infirmary.
Report.
Cardinal Mustafa is conscious, sir. Still blind, of course, in terrible pain, but...
Put him on, snapped Walmack.
A terrible visage filled the hollow sphere. Captain Walmack sensed others on the bridge shrinking back. The Grand Inquisitor's face was still bloodied. His teeth were bright red as he screamed. His eye sockets were ragged and void, except for tendrils of torn tissue and rivulets of blood. At first, Captain Walmack could not discern the word from the shriek. But then he realized what the Cardinal was screaming.
Nemes! Nemes! Nemes!
The constructs called Nemes, Scylla, and Briareus continue eastward. The 3 remain phase-shifted, oblivious to the staggering amounts of energy this consumes. The energy is sent from elsewhere. It is not their worry. All of their existence has led to this hour. After the timeless interlude of slaughter under the Pargo-Kaling Western Gate, Nemes leads the way up the tower and across the great metal cables holding the suspension bridge in place.
The three jog through Drepung Marketplace, three motile figures moving through thickened amber air, past human forms frozen in place. At Fari Marketplace, the thousands of shopping, browsing, laughing, arguing, jostling human statues make Nemes smile her thin-lipped smile. She could decapitate all of them, and they would have had no warning of their destruction. But she has an objective. At the Fari Ridge cableway juncture, the three shift down. Friction on the cable would be a problem otherwise. Scylla, the northern highway. Nemes sends on the common band. Briareus, the middle bridge. I will take the cableway. Her siblings nod, shimmer, and are gone. The cablemaster steps forward to protest Nemesis shoving in line ahead of scores of waiting cable passengers. It is a busy time of day. Radamanth Nemes picks the cablemaster up and flings him off the platform. A dozen angry men and women shove toward her, shouting, bent on revenge. Nemes leaps from the platform and grabs the cable. She has no pulley, no brakes, no climbing harness. She phase shifts only the palms of her inhuman hands and hurtles down the cable toward Kunlun Ridge. The angry mob behind her clip onto the cable and give chase, a dozen, two dozen more. The cablemaster had been liked by many. It takes Nemes half the usual transit time to cover the great abyss between Fari and Kunlun Ridges. She brakes sloppily on the approach and slams into the rock, phase shifting at the last instant. Pulling herself out of the crumbling indentation on the cliff behind the landing ledge, she walks back to the cable. Pulleys whine as the first of her pursuers careen down the last few hundred meters of wire. More spread out to the horizon, black beads on a thin string. Nemes smiles, phase shifts both her hands, reaches high, and severs the cable. She is surprised how few of the dozens of doomed men and women scream as they slide off the twisting, falling cable to their deaths. Nemes jogs to the fixed ropes, climbs them freehand, and cuts all of them loose. Ascent lines, rappel lines, safety lines, everything. Five armed members of the Kunlun Constabulary from Si Huang Mu confront her on the ridgeline just south of the slideway. She phase shifts only her left forearm and swats them off into space. Looking northwest, Nemes adjusts her infrared and telescopic vision and zooms in on the great swinging bonsai bamboo bridge connecting the highway promontories between Fari Ridge and Kunlun Ridge. The bridge falls as she watches, the slats and vines and support cables writhing as they fall back to the western ridgeline, the lower reaches of the bridge dropping into phosgene clouds.
"That's that," sends Briareus.
"How many on it when it fell?" queries Nemes.
"Many,"
Briareus disconnects. A second later, Scylla logs on.
"Northern bridge down. I'm destroying the highway as I go."
"Good," sends Nemes. "I'll see you in Joe Kung."
The three shift down as they pass through the city fissure at Joe Kung. It is raining lightly, the clouds as thick as summer fog. Nemes' thin hair is plastered to her forehead, and she notices that Scylla and Briareus have the same look. The crowd parts for them. The ledge road to the temple hanging in air is empty. Nemes is leading as they approach the final short swinging bridge before the ledge below the stairway to the temple. This had been the first artifact repaired by Anea, a simple 20-meter swinging span above a narrow fissure between dolomite spires 1,000 meters above the lower crags and cloud tops. And now the monsoon clouds billow beneath and around the dripping structure. Invisible in the thick clouds, something stands on the cliff ledge at the other side of the bridge. Nemes shifts to thermal imaging and smiles when she sees that the tall shape radiates no heat whatsoever. She pings it with her forehead-generated radar and studies the image. 3 meters tall, thorns, bladed fingers on four oversized hands, a perfectly radar-reflective carapace, sharp blades on chest and forehead, no respiration, razor wire rising from the shoulders and spikes from the forehead.
"Perfect," sends Nemes.
"Perfect," agrees Scylla and Briareus. The figure at the other end of the dripping bridge makes no response.
We made it to the mountain with only a few meters to spare. Once we dropped out of the lower reaches of the jet stream, our descent was steady and irreversible. There were few thermals out above the cloud ocean and many downdrafts. And while we made the first half of the 100-click gap in a few minutes of thrilling acceleration, the second half was all heart-stopping descent. Now certain that we would make it with room to spare, now more certain that we would drop into the clouds and never even see our deaths rising to surround us until the kite wings struck acid sea. We did descend into the clouds, but these were the monsoon clouds, the water vapor clouds, the breathable clouds. The three of us flew as close as we could, blue delta, yellow delta, green delta. The metal and fabric of our para-wings almost touching, more fearful of losing one another and dying alone than of striking one another and falling together. Anea and I had the comm threads, but we talked to each other just once during that suspenseful descent to the east. The fog had thickened. I caught the merest glimpses of her yellow wing to my left, and I was thinking, she had a child. She married someone else. She loved someone else. When I heard her voice on the hear patch of my suit. Rawl? Yes, kiddo. I love you, Rawl. I hesitated a few heartbeats, but the emotional vacuum that had pulled me a moment earlier was swept away in the surge of affection for my young friend and lover. I love you, Anea. We swept lower through the murk. I thought that I could taste an acrid scent on the wind, the fringes of the phosgene clouds. Kiddo? Yes, Rawl? Her voice was a whisper in my ears. We had both removed our osmosis masks, I knew, although they would have protected us from the phosgene. We did not know if Abetic could breathe the poison. If he could not, the unspoken plan between Anea and me was to close our masks and hope that we could reach the edges of the mountain before we struck the acid sea, dragging the android up the slope and out of the poison air if we could. We both knew that it was a flimsy plan. The radar aboard the ship during my initial descent had shown me that most of the peaks and ridges dropped abruptly beneath the phosgene cloud layer, and it would only be a matter of minutes between entering the poisonous clouds before we struck the sea anyway. But it was better to have a plan than to surrender to fate. In the meantime, we both had our masks up, breathing fresh air while we could. Kiddo, I said, if you know that this isn't going to work, if you've seen what you think is... my death? She completed the sentence for me. I could not have said it aloud. I nodded stupidly. She could not see me through the clouds between us. They're only possibilities, Rawl, she said softly. Although the one I know of with the greatest probability is not this. Don't worry, I wouldn't have asked you both to go with me if I thought this was... it. I heard the humor in her voice through the tension. I know, I said, glad that Abetic could not pick up this conversation. I wasn't thinking of that. I had been thinking that perhaps she had known that the android and I would make it to the mountain, but she would not. I did not believe that now. As long as my fate was entwined with hers, I could accept about anything. I was just wondering why we were running again, kiddo, I said. I'm sick of running away from the packs. So am I, said Anea. And trust me, Rawl, that's not all we're doing here. Oh, shit. Hardly the quotable pronouncement from a messiah, but in a second I saw the reason for her shout. A rocky hillside had appeared 20 meters ahead of us, large boulders visible between scree slopes, sheer cliffs lower down. Abetic led the way in, pulling up on his control bar at the last minute and dropping his legs from the stirrups of the rigging, using the kite like a parachute above him. He bounced twice on his boots and set the kite down quickly, snapping off his harness. Lomo had shown us many times that it was important on dangerous and windy landing sites to separate yourself from the para-wing quickly so that it did not drag you over some edge. And there was definitely an edge to be dragged over here. Anea landed next, me a few seconds later.
I had the sloppiest of the three landings, bouncing high, dropping almost straight down, twisting my ankle on the small stones, and going to my knees while the parawing struck hard on a boulder above me, bending metal and rending fabric. The kite tried to tip over backward then, pulling me over the cliff's edge just as Lomo had warned. But Abedic grabbed the left struts, Aeneas seized the broken right spar a second later, and they stabilized it long enough for me to struggle out of my harness and hobble a few steps away from the wreckage, dragging my backpack with me. Aeneas knelt on the cold, wet rocks at my feet, loosening my boot and studying my ankle. "I don't think it's sprained badly," she said. "It may swell a bit, but you should be able to walk on it all right."
"Good," I said stupidly, aware only of her bare hands on my bare ankle. Then I jumped a bit as she sprayed something cold from her med kit on the puffy flesh. They both helped me to my feet. We gathered our gear, and the three of us started arm in arm up the slick slope toward where the clouds glowed more brightly. We came up into the sunlight high on the sacred slopes of Tai Shan. I had pulled off the skin suit cowl and mask, but Aeneas suggested that I keep the suit on. I pulled my therm jacket on over it to feel less naked, and I noticed that my friend did the same. Abedic was rubbing his arms, and I saw that the high-altitude cold had left his flesh chilled almost white. "Are you all right?" I asked him.
"Fine, Emendymion," said the android, "although another few minutes at that altitude..."
I looked down at the clouds where we had folded the damaged kites and left them.
"I guess we're not getting off this hill with the parawings."
"Correct," said Aeneas. "Look." We had come out of the boulder fields and scree slopes to grassy highlands between great cliffs, the succulent meadows crisscrossed with zygote trails and stepping stone paths. Glacial melt streams trickled over rocks, but there were bridges made of stone slabs. A few distant herders had watched us impassively as we climbed higher. Now we had come around a switchback below the great ice fields and looked up at what could only be temples of white stone set on gray ramparts. The gleaming buildings, bright beneath the blue-white expanse of ice and snow slopes that stretched up and out of sight to the blue zenith, looked like altars. What Aeneas had pointed out was a great white stone set next to the trail, with this poem carved in its smooth face. "With what can I compare the great peak? Over the surrounding provinces, its blue-green hue never dwindles from sight. Infused by the shaper of forms with the soaring power of divinity, shaded and sunlit, its slopes divide night from day. Breast heaving as I climb toward the clouds, eyes straining to follow birds flying home. Someday I shall reach its peerless summit and behold all mountains in a single glance." Tu Fu, Tang Dynasty, China, Old Earth. And so we entered Tai'an, the city of peace. There on the slopes were the scores of temples, hundreds of shops, inns, and homes, countless small shrines, and a busy street filled with stalls, each covered by a bright canvas awning. The people here were lovely. That is a poor word, but the only proper one, I think. All with dark hair, bright eyes, gleaming teeth, healthy skin, and a pride and vigor to their carriage and step. Their clothes were silk and dyed cotton, bright but elegantly simple, and there were many, many monks in orange and red robes. The crowds would have been forgiven if they had stared. No one visits Tai Shan during the monsoon months, but all the glances I saw were welcoming and easy. Indeed, many of the people in the street milled around, greeting Aeneas by name and touching her hand or sleeve. I remembered then that she had visited the great peak before. Aeneas pointed out the great slab of white rock that covered a hillside above the City of Peace. On the polished face of that slab had been carved what she explained was the Diamond Sutra in huge Chinese characters. One of the principal works of Buddhist philosophy, she explained,
It reminded the monk and passerby of the ultimate nature of reality, as symbolized in the empty expanse of blue sky overhead. Ania also pointed out the first heavenly gate at the edge of the city, a gigantic stone archway under a red pagoda roof, with the first of the 27,000 steps starting up toward the jade summit. Incredibly, we had been expected. In the great gompa at the center of the City of Peace, more than 1,200 red-robed monks sat cross-legged in patient files, waiting for Ania. The resident lama greeted Ania with a low bow. She helped him to his feet and hugged the old man. And then Abedic and I were sitting at one side of the low, cushioned dais, while Ania briefly addressed the waiting multitude. "I said last spring that I would return at this time," she said softly, her voice perfectly clear in the great marble space. "And it pleases my heart to see you all again. For those of you who took communion with me during my last visit, I know that you have discovered the truth of learning the language of the dead, of learning the language of the living, and, for some of you, of hearing the music of the spheres, and soon, I promise you, of taking that first step. This day is a sad day in many ways, but our future is bright with optimism and change. I am honored that you have allowed me to be your teacher. I am honored that we have shared our exploration of a universe that is rich beyond imagining." She paused and looked at Abedic and me. "These are my companions, my friend Abedic and my beloved Rawl Endymion. They have shared all hardships of my longest life's voyage with me, and they will share in today's pilgrimage. When we leave you, we will pass this day through the three heavenly gates, enter the mouth of the dragon, and, Buddha and the fates of chaos willing, shall visit the princess of azure clouds and see the temple of the Jade Emperor this day." Ania paused again and looked at the shaven heads and bright dark eyes. These were not religious fanatics, I saw. Not mindless servants or self-punishing ascetics, but were instead row upon row of intelligent, questioning, alert young men and women. I say young, but among the fresh and youthful faces were many with gray beards and subtle wrinkles. "My dear friend the Lama tells me that there are more now who wish to share in communion with the void which binds this day," said Ania. About 100 of the monks in the front rows went to their knees. Ania nodded. "So it shall be," she said softly. The lama brought flagons of wine and many simple bronze cups. Before filling the cups or lancing her finger for the drops of blood, Ania said, "But before you partake of this communion, I must remind you that this is a physical change, not a spiritual one. Your individual quest for God or enlightenment must remain just that, your individual quest. This moment of change will not bring Satori or salvation. It will bring only change." My young friend held up one finger, the finger she was about to prick to draw blood. "In the cells of my blood are unique DNA and RNA arrangements, along with certain viral agents which will invade your body, starting through the digestive lining of your stomachs and ending in every cell of your body. These invasive viruses are somatic, that is, they shall be passed along to your children. I have taught your teachers, and they have taught you that these physical changes will allow you, after some training, to touch the void which binds more directly, thus learning the language of the dead and of the living. Eventually, with much more experience and training, it may be possible for you to hear the music of the spheres and take a true step elsewhere." She raised the finger higher. "This is not metaphysics, my dear friends. This is a mutant viral agent. Be warned that you will never be able to wear the cruciform of the Pax, nor will your children nor their children's children. This basic change in the soul of your genes and chromosomes will ban you from that form of physical longevity forever. This communion will not offer you immortality, my dear friends.
it ensures that death will be our common end. I say again, I do not offer you eternal life or instant satori. If these are the things you seek most dearly, you must find them in your own religious searchings. I offer you only a deepening of the human experience of life and a connection to others, human or not, who have shared that commitment to living. There is no shame if you change your mind now, but there is duty, discomfort, and great danger to those who partake of this communion and, in so doing, become teachers themselves of the void which binds, as well as fellow carriers of this new virus of human choice. Aeneas waited, but none of the 100 monks moved or left. All remained kneeling, heads slightly bowed as if in contemplation. "So be it," said Aeneas. "I wish you all well." And she pricked her finger, squeezing a droplet of blood into each prepared cup of wine held out by the elderly lama. It took only a few minutes for the 100 monks to pass the cups down their rows, each drinking but a drop. I rose from my cushion then, determined to go to the end of the row nearest me and partake of this communion, but Aeneas beckoned me to her. "Not yet, my dear," she whispered in my ear, touching my shoulder. I was tempted to argue. Why was I being excluded from this? But instead returned to my place next to Abetic. I leaned over and whispered to the android. "You haven't done this so-called communion, have you?" The blue man smiled. "No, Emendymion, and I never shall." I was about to ask why, but at that moment the communion ended. The 1,200 monks rose to their feet. Aeneas walked among them, chatting and touching hands. And I saw from her glance toward me over shaven heads that it was time for us to leave. Nemes, Scylla, and Briareus regard the shrike across the expanse of the suspension bridge, not phase-shifting for a moment, appreciating the real-time view of their enemy. "It's absurd," sends Briareus, "a child's boogeyman. All spikes and thorns and teeth, how silly." "Tell that to Gyges," responds Nemes. "Ready?" "Ready," sends Scylla. "Ready," sends Briareus. The three phase shift in unison. Nemes sees the air around them go thick and heavy, light becoming a sepia syrup. And she knows that even if the shrike now does the obvious, cutting the suspension bridge supports, that it will make no difference. In fast time, it will take ages for the bridge to begin to fall. Time enough for the trio to cross it 1,000 times. In single file, Nemes leading, they cross it now. The shrike does not change position. Its head does not move to follow them. Its red eyes gleam dully like crimson glass reflecting the last bit of sunset.
"Something's not right here," sends Briareus.
"Quiet," commands Nemes. "Stay off the common band unless I open contact." She is less than 10 meters from the shrike now, and still the thing has not reacted. Nemes continues forward through thick air until she steps onto solid stone. Her clone sister follows, taking up position on Nemes's left. Briareus steps off the bridge and stands on Nemes's right. They are 3 meters in front of the Hyperion legend. It remains quiescent.
"Move out of the way or be destroyed," Nemes shifts down long enough to speak to the chrome statue. "Your day is long past. The girl is ours today."
The shrike does not respond.
"Destroy it," Nemes commands her siblings, and phase shifts.
The shrike disappears, shifting through time. Nemes blinks as the temporal shockwaves ripple over and through her, and then surveys the frozen surroundings with the full spectrum of her vision. There are a few human beings still here at the temple hanging in air, but no shrike.
"Shift down," she commands, and her siblings obey immediately.
The world brightens, the air moves, and sound returns.
"Find her," says Nemes.
In a full jog, Scylla moves to the noble eightfold path Axis of Wisdom and lopes up the staircase to the platform of Right Understanding. Briareus moves quickly to the Axis of Morality and leaps to the pagoda of Right Speech.
Nemes takes the third stairway, the highest, toward the high pavilions of right mindfulness and right meditation. Her radar shows people in the highest structure. She arrives in a few seconds, scanning the buildings and cliff wall for concealed rooms or hiding places. Nothing. There is a young woman in the pavilion for right meditation, and for an instant Nemes thinks that the search is over. But although she is about the same age as Aenea, it is not her. There are a few others in the elegant pagoda. A very old woman. Nemes recognizes her as the thunderbolt sow from the Dalai Lama's reception. The Dalai Lama's chief crier and head of security, Carl Lingo William Ihagee, and the boy himself, the Dalai Lama.
"Where is she?" says Nemes. "Where is the one who calls herself Aenea?"
Before any of the others can speak, the warrior Ihagee reaches into his cloak and hurls a dagger with lightning speed. Nemes dodges it easily. Even without phase shifting, her reactions are faster than most humans. But when Ihagee pulls a flechette pistol, Nemes shifts up, walks to the frozen man, encloses him in her shift field, and flings him out the open floor-to-ceiling window into the abyss. Of course, as soon as Ihagee leaves her field envelope, he seems to freeze in midair, like some ungainly bird thrown from the nest, unable to fly but unwilling to fall. Nemes turns back to the boy and shifts down. Behind her, Ihagee screams and plummets out of sight. The Dalai Lama's jaw drops and his lips form an O. To him and the two women present, Ihagee had simply disappeared from next to them and reappeared in midair out the open shoji doors of the pavilion, as if he had chosen to teleport to his death.
"You can't," begins the old thunderbolt sow.
"You are forbidden," begins the Dalai Lama.
"You won't,"
begins the woman whom Nemes guesses is either Rachel or Theo, Aenea's compatriots. Nemes says nothing. She shifts up, walks to the boy, folds her phase field around him, lifts him, and carries him to the open door.
"Nemes!"
It is Briareus calling from the pavilion of right effort.
"What?"
Instead of verbalizing on the common band, Briareus uses the extra energy to send the full visual image. Looking frozen in the sepia air kilometers above them, fusion flame as solid as a blue pillar, a spaceship is descending.
"Shift down," commands Nemes.
The monks and the old lama packed us a lunch in a brown bag. They also gave Abedic one of the old-fashioned pressure suits of the kind I had seen only in the ancient spaceflight museum at Port Romance, and tried to give two more to Aenea and me, but we showed them the skin suits under our thermal jackets. The 1,200 monks all turned out to wave us off through the first heavenly gate, and there must have been 2,000 or 3,000 others pressing and craning to see us leave. The great stairway was empty, except for the three of us, climbing easily now. Abetic with his clear helmet folded back like a cowl. Aenea and me with our osmosis masks turned up. Each of the steps was 7 meters wide, but shallow. And the first section was easy enough, with a wide terrace step every 100 steps. The steps were heated from within, so even as we moved into the region of perpetual ice and snow midway up Taishan, the stairway was clear. Within an hour we had reached the second heavenly gate, a huge red pagoda with a 15-meter archway, and then we were climbing more steeply up the near-vertical fault line known as the Mouth of the Dragon. Here the winds picked up, the temperature dropped precipitously, and the air became dangerously thin. We had redonned our harnesses at the second heavenly gate, and now we clipped onto one of the bucky carbon lines that ran along each side of the staircase, adjusting the pulley grip to act like a brake if we fell or were blown off the increasingly treacherous staircase. Within minutes, Abetic inflated his clear helmet and gave us a thumbs up, while Aenea and I sealed our osmosis masks. We kept climbing toward the south gate of heaven still a kilometer above us, while the world fell away all around. It was the second time in a few hours that such a sight had presented itself to us, but this time we took it all in every 300 steps as we took a break,
standing and wheezing and staring out at the early afternoon light illuminating the great peaks. Tai'an, the city of peace, was invisible now, some 15,000 steps and several clicks below the ice fields and rock walls through which we had climbed. I realized that the skin suit comm threads gave us privacy once again, and said, "How you doing, kiddo?"
"Tired," said Ania.
But she leavened the comment with a smile from behind her clear mask.
"Can you tell me where we're headed?"
I said.
"The Temple of the Jade Emperor," said my friend. "It's on the summit."
"I guess that," I said, setting a foot down on the wide step, then raising the next foot to the next step. The stairway passed up and through a rock and ice overhang at this point. I knew that if I turned around to look down, that vertigo might overcome me. This was infinitely worse than the paragliding.
"Can you tell me why we're climbing to the Temple of the Jade Emperor, when everything is going to hell behind us?"
"How do you mean going to hell?" she said.
"I mean Nemes and her ilk are probably after us. The Pax definitely is going to make its move. Things are falling apart, and we're on pilgrimage."
Ania nodded. The wind was roaring now, as thin as it was, as we actually climbed into the jet stream. Each of us was moving forward and up, with our heads bowed and our bodies arched, as if carrying a heavy load. I wondered what Abetic was thinking about.
"Why don't we just call the ship and get the hell out of here?" I said. "If we're going to bail out, let's get it over with."
I could see Ania's dark eyes behind the mask that reflected the deepening blue sky. "When we call the ship, there'll be 24 Pax warships descending on us like harpy crows," said Ania. "We can't do it until we're ready." I gestured up the steep staircase.
"And climbing this will make us ready?"
"I hope so," she said softly. I could hear the rasp of her breathing through my ear patches.
"What's up here, kiddo?"
We had reached the next 300th step. All three of us stopped and panted, too tired to appreciate the view. We had climbed into the edge of space. The sky was almost black. Several of the brighter stars were visible, and I could see one of the smaller moons hurtling toward the zenith. Or was it a packed ship?
"I don't know what we'll find, Rawl," said Ania, her voice tired. "I glimpse things, dream things again and again. But then I dream the same thing in a different way. I hate to talk about it until I see which reality presents itself."
I nodded understanding, but I was lying. We began climbing again.
"Ania," I said.
"Yes, Rawl."
"Why don't you let me take, you know, communion?"
She made a face behind the osmosis mask.
"I hate calling it that."
"I know, but that's what everyone calls it. But tell me this, at least. Why don't you let me drink the wine?"
"It's not time for you to, Rawl."
"Why not?"
I could feel the anger and frustration just below the surface again, mixing with the roiling current of love that I felt for this woman.
"You know the four steps I talk about?" she began.
"Learning the language of the dead, learning the language of the living. Yeah, yeah, I know the four steps," I said, almost dismissively,
setting my very real foot on a very physical marble step and taking another tired pace up the endless stairway. I could see Ania smile at my tone.
"Those things tend to preoccupy the person first encountering them," she said softly. "I need your full attention right now. I need your help."
That made sense to me. I reached over and touched her back through the thermal jacket and skin suit material. Abetic looked across at us and nodded, as if approving of our contact. I reminded myself that he could not have heard our skin suit transmissions.
"Ania,"
I said softly,
"are you the new Messiah?"
I could hear her sigh.
"No, Rawl. I never said I was a Messiah. I never wanted to be a Messiah. I'm just a tired young woman right now. I've got a pounding headache and cramps. It's the first day of my period."
She must have seen me blink in surprise or shock.
Well, hell, I thought. It's not every day that you get to confront the Messiah, only to hear that she's suffering from what the ancients used to call PMS.
Ania chuckled. I'm not the Messiah, Rawl. I was just chosen to be the one who teaches, and I'm trying to do it while I can.
Something about her last sentence made my stomach knot in anxiety.
Okay, I said.
We reached the 300th step and paused together, wheezing more heavily now. I looked up, still no south gate of heaven visible. Even though it was midday, the sky was space black. 1,000 stars burned. They barely twinkled. I realized that the hiss and roar of the jet stream had gone away. Taishan was the highest peak on Tian Shan, extending into the highest fringes of the atmosphere. If it had not been for our skin suits, our eyes, eardrums, and lungs would have exploded like overinflated balloons. Our blood would be boiling. I tried to shift my thoughts onto something else.
All right, I said. But if you were the Messiah, what would your message to humanity be?
Ania chuckled again. But I noticed that it was a reflective chuckle, not a derisive one.
If you were a Messiah, she said between breaths, what would your message be?
I laughed out loud. Abetic could not have heard the sound through the near vacuum separating us, but he must have seen me throw my head back, for he looked over quizzically. I waved at him and said to Ania, I have no fucking clue.
Exactly, said Ania. When I was a kid, I mean a little kid before I met you, and I knew that I'd have to go through some of this stuff, I was always wondering what message I was going to give humankind. Beyond the things I knew I'd have to teach, I mean. Something profound, sort of a Sermon on the Mount. I looked around. There was no ice or snow at this terrible altitude. The clear white steps rose through shelves of steep black rock.
Well, I said, here's the mount.
Yeah, said Ania, and I could hear the fatigue once again.
So what message did you come up with? I said, more to keep her talking and distracted than to hear the answer. It had been a while since she and I had just talked. I could see her smile.
I kept working on it, she said at last, trying to get it as short and important as the Sermon on the Mount. Then I realized that was no good, like Uncle Martin in his manic poet period trying to outwrite Shakespeare. So I decided that my message would just be shorter.
How short?
I got my message down to 35 words. Too long. Then down to 27. Still too long. After a few years, I had it down to 10. Still too long. Eventually, I boiled it down to 2 words.
2 words? I said. Which two?
We had reached the next resting point, the 70th or 80th 300th step. We stopped gratefully and panted. I bent over to rest my skin suit gloved hands on my skin suit sheathed knees and concentrated on not throwing up. It was bad form to vomit in an osmosis mask.
Which two?
I said again, when I got some wind back and could hear the answer over my pounding heart and rasping lungs.
Choose again, said Ania.
I considered that for a wheezing, panting moment.
Choose again, I said finally.
Ania smiled. She had caught her wind and was actually looking down at the vertical view that I was afraid even to glance toward. She seemed to be enjoying it. I had the friendly urge to toss her off the mountain right then. Youth, it's intolerable sometimes.
Choose again, she said firmly.
Care to elaborate on that?
No, said Ania. That's the whole idea. Keep it simple. But name a category and you get the idea.
Religion, I said.
Choose again, said Ania.
I laughed.
I'm not being totally facetious here, Rawl, she said.
We began climbing again. Abetic seemed lost in thought.
I know, kiddo, I said, although I had not been sure.
Categories, political systems.
Choose again.
You don't think that the Pax is the ultimate evolution of human society? It's brought interstellar peace, fairly good government, and, oh yeah, immortality to its citizens.
It's time to choose again, said Aenea. And speaking of our views of evolution,
what?
Choose again.
Choose what again, I said. The direction of evolution?
No, said Aenea. I mean our ideas about whether evolution has a direction. Most of our theories about evolution, for that matter.
So do you or don't you agree with Pope Teilhard, the Hyperion pilgrim Father Duray, when he said 3 centuries ago that Teilhard de Chardin had been right, that the universe was evolving toward consciousness and a conjunction with the Godhead, what he called the Omega Point?
Aenea looked at me. You did do a lot of reading in the Taliesin Library, didn't you?
Yeah.
No, I don't agree with Teilhard, either the original Jesuit or the short-lived Pope. My mother knew both Father Doré and the current pretender, Father Hoyt, you know.
I blinked.
I guess I had known that, but being reminded of the reality of it, of my friend's connections across the last 3 centuries, set me back a bit. Anyway, continued Aenea, evolutionary science has really taken a bite in the butt over the last millennium. First, the Corps actively opposed investigation into it because of their fear of rapid human-designed genetic engineering, an explosion of our species into variant forms upon which the Corps could not be parasitic. Then evolution and the biosciences were ignored by the hegemony for centuries because of the Corps' influence, and now the Pax is terrified of it.
Why? I said.
Why is the Pax terrified of biological and genetic research?
No, I said, I think I understand that. The Corps wants to keep human beings in the form and shape they're comfortable with, and so does the Church. They define being human largely by counting arms, legs, and so forth. But I mean, why redefine evolution? Why open up the argument about direction or non-direction and so forth? Doesn't the ancient theory hold up pretty well?
No, said Aenea. We climbed several minutes in silence. Then she said, except for mystics such as the original Teilhard, most early evolution scientists were very careful not to think of evolution in terms of goals or purposes. That was religion, not science. Even the idea of a direction was anathema to the pre-Hegira scientists. They could only speak in terms of tendencies in evolution, sort of statistical quirks that kept recurring. So that was their short-sighted bias, just as Teilhard de Chardin's was his faith. There are directions in evolution.
How do you know? I said softly, wondering if she would answer. She answered quickly.
Some of the data I saw before I was born, she said, through my cybered father's connections to the Corps. The autonomous intelligences there have understood human evolution for many centuries, even while humans stayed ignorant. As hyper-hyper-parasites, the AIs evolve only toward greater parasitism. They can only look at living things and their evolutionary curve and watch it, or try to stop it.
So what are the directions in evolution, I asked. Toward greater intelligence? Toward some sort of godlike hive mind? I was curious about her perception of the lions and tigers and bears.
Hive mind, said Aenea.
Ugh! Can you conceive of anything more boring or distasteful?
I said nothing. I had rather imagined that this was the direction of her teachings about learning the language of the dead and all that. I made a note to listen better the next time she taught.
Almost everything interesting in the human experience is the result of an individual experiencing, experimenting, explaining, and sharing, said my young friend. A hive mind would be the ancient television broadcasts, or life at the height of the datasphere, consensual idiocy.
Okay, I said, still confused. What direction does evolution take?
Toward more life, said Aenea. Life likes life. It's pretty much that simple. But more amazingly, non-life likes life as well, and wants to get into it.
I don't understand, I said.
Aenea nodded. Back on pre-Hegira Old Earth, in the 1920s, there was a geologist from a nation-state called Russia who understood this stuff.
His name was Vladimir Vernadsky, and he coined the phrase biosphere, which, if things happen the way I think they will, should take on new meaning for both of us soon.
Why?
I said. You'll see, my friend, said Ania, touching my gloved hand with hers. Anyway, Vernadsky wrote in 1926, Atoms, once drawn into the torrent of living matter, do not readily leave it. I thought about this for a moment. I did not know much science. What I had picked up came from Grandam and the Taliesin Library, but this made sense to me. It was phrased more scientifically 1,200 years ago as Dalo's Law, said Ania. The essence of it is that evolution doesn't back up. Exceptions like the old earth whale trying to become a fish again after living as a land mammal are just the rare exception. Life moves on. It constantly finds new niches to invade.
Yeah, I said. Such as when humanity left old earth in its seed ships and Hawking drive vessels.
Not really, said Ania. First of all, we did that prematurely because of the influence of the core and the fact that old earth was dying because of a black hole in its belly. Also the core's work. Secondly, because of the Hawking drive, we could jump through our arm of the galaxy to find Earth-like worlds high on the Solmev scale, most of which we terraformed anyway and seeded with old Earth life forms, starting with soil bacteria and earthworms and moving up to the ducks you used to hunt in the Hyperion fens. I nodded. But I was thinking, how else should we have done it as a species moving out into space? What's wrong with going to places that looked and smelled somewhat like home, especially when home wasn't going to be there to go back to?
There's something more interesting in Vernadsky's observations and Dalo's Law, said Ania.
What's that, kiddo?
I was still thinking about ducks.
Life doesn't retreat.
How so?
As soon as I asked the question, I understood.
Yeah, said my friend, seeing my understanding. As soon as life gets a foothold somewhere, it stays. You name it, Arctic cold, the old Mars frozen desert, boiling hot springs, a sheer rock face such as here on Tian Shan, even in autonomous intelligence programs. Once life gets its proverbial foot in the door, it stays forever.
So what are the implications of that? I said.
Simply that left to its own devices, which are clever devices, life will someday fill the universe, said Ania. It will be a green galaxy to begin with, then off to our neighboring clusters and galaxies.
That's a disturbing thought, I said.
She paused to look at me.
Why, Rawl? I think it's beautiful.
Green planets I've seen, I said. A green atmosphere is imaginable but weird.
She smiled. It doesn't have to be just plants. Life adapts. Birds, men and women in flying machines, you and me in paragliders, people adapted to flight.
That hasn't happened yet, I said. But what I meant was, well, to have a green galaxy, people and animals and...
And living machines, said Ania, and androids, artificial life of a thousand forms.
Yeah, people, animals, machines, androids, whatever, would have to adapt to space. I don't see how...
We have, said Ania, and more will before too long.
We reached the next 300th step and paused to pant.
What other directions are there in evolution that we've ignored? I said when we began to climb again.
Increasing diversity and complexity, said Ania. Scientists argued back and forth about these directions for centuries, but there's no doubt that evolution favors, in the very long run, both these attributes. And of the two, diversity is the more important.
Why? I said. She must have been growing tired of that syllable. I sounded like a 3-year-old child, even to myself.
Scientists used to think that basic evolutionary designs kept multiplying, said Ania. That's called disparity. But that turned out not to be the case. Variety in basic plans tends to decrease as life's anti-entropic potential, evolution, increases. Look at all the orphans of old Earth, for instance. Same basic DNA, of course, but also the same basic plans. Evolved from forms with tubular guts, radial symmetry, eyes, feeding mouths, two sexes, pretty much from the same mold.
But I thought you said diversity was important, I said.
It is, said Aenea. But diversity is different than basic plan disparity. Once evolution gets a good basic design, it tends to throw away the variance and concentrate on the near-infinite diversity within that design. Thousands of related species, tens of thousands.
Trilobites, I said, getting the idea.
Yes, said Aenea, and when?
Beetles, I said. All those goddamn species of beetles.
Aenea grinned at me through her mask. Precisely, and when?
Bugs, I said. Every world I've been on has the same goddamn swarms of bugs, mosquitoes, endless varieties of...
You've got it, said Aenea. Life shifts into high gear when the basic plan for an organism is settled and new niches open up. Life settles into those new niches by tweaking the diversity within the basic shape of those organisms. New species. There are thousands of new species of plants and animals that have come into existence in just the last millennium since interstellar flight started. And not all bioengineered. Some just adapted at a furious rate to the new Earth-like worlds they were dumped down on.
Triaspens, I said, remembering just Hyperion. Everblues. Woman grove root. Tesla trees?
They were native, said Aenea.
So the diversity's good, I said, trying to find the original threads of this discussion.
Diversity's good, agreed Aenea. As I said, it lets life shift into high gear and get on with its mindless business of greening up the universe. But there's at least one old Earth species that hasn't diversified much at all, at least not on the friendly worlds it colonized.
Us, I said. Humans.
Aenea nodded grimly. We've been stuck in one species since our Cro-Magnon ancestors helped to wipe out the smarter Neanderthals, she said. Now it's our chance to diversify rapidly, and institutions like the Hegemony, the Pax, and the Core are stopping it.
Does the need to diversify extend to human institutions, I said? Religions, social systems?
I was thinking about the people who had helped me on Vitus Gray, Bolianus B, Demria, Demloa, and their families. I was thinking about the Amoyeti Spectrum Helix and its complicated and convoluted beliefs.
Absolutely, said Aenea. Look over there.
A. Betic had paused at a slab of marble upon which words were carved in Chinese and early Web English. High rises the eastern peak, soaring up to the blue sky. Among the rocks, an empty hollow, secret, still, mysterious. Uncarved and unhewn, screened by nature with a roof of clouds. Time and seasons, what things are you? Bringing to my life ceaseless change. I will lodge forever in this hollow, where springs and autumns unheeded pass. Tao Yun, wife of General Wang Ning Chi, A.D. 400. We climbed on. I thought that I could see something red at the top of this next flight of stairs. The south gate of heaven and entry to the summit slope? It was about time. Wasn't that beautiful, though? I said, speaking of the poem. Isn't continuity like that as important or more important in human institutions as diversity?
It's important, agreed Aenea. But that's almost all humanity has been doing for the last millennium, Rawl. Recreating old Earth institutions and ideas on different worlds. Look at the Hegemony. Look at the Church and the Pax. Look at this world.
Tian Shan, I said. I think it's wonderful.
So do I, said Aenea. But it's all borrowed. The Buddhism has evolved a bit, at least away from idolatry and ritual, back to the open-mindedness that was its earliest hallmark. But everything else is pretty much an attempt to recapture things lost with old Earth.
Such as, I said.
Such as the language, dress, the names of the mountains, local customs. Hell, Rawl, even this pilgrimage trail and the temple of the Jade Emperor, if we ever get there.
You mean there is a Taishan mountain on old Earth? I said.
Absolutely, said Aenea. With its own city of peace and heavenly gates and mouth of the dragon. Confucius climbed it more than 3,000 years ago. But the old Earth stairway had just 7,000 steps.
I wish we'd climbed it instead, I said, wondering if I could keep climbing. The steps were short, but there had been a hell of a lot of them.
I see your point, though.
Ania nodded. It's wonderful to preserve tradition, but a healthy organism evolves, culturally and physically.
Which brings us back to evolution, I said. What are the other directions, tendencies, goals, or whatever that you said had been ignored the last few centuries?
There are just a few more, said Ania. One is an ever-increasing number of individuals. Life likes gazillions of species, but it absolutely loves hyper-gazillions of individuals. In a sense, the universe is tooled up for individuals. There was a book in the Taliesin Library called Evolving Hierarchical Systems by an old Earth guy named Stanley Southey. Did you see it?
No, I must have missed it when I was reading those early 21st century holoporn novels.
Uh-huh, said Ania. Well, Southey put it sort of neatly. An indefinite number of unique individuals can exist in a finite material world if they are nested within each other and that world is expanding.
Nested within each other, I repeated, thinking about it. Yeah, I get it. Like the old Earth bacteria in our gut, and the paramecia we've dragged into space, and the other cells in our bodies. More worlds, more people, yeah.
The trick is more people, said Ania. We have hundreds of billions, but between the Fall and the Pax, the actual human population in the galaxy, not counting ousters, has leveled off in the last few hundred years.
Well, birth control is important, I said, repeating what everyone on Hyperion had been taught. I mean, especially with the cruciform, capable of keeping people alive for centuries and centuries.
Exactly, said Ania. With artificial immortality comes more stagnation, physical and cultural. It's a given.
I frowned.
But that's not a reason to deny people the chance for extended life, is it?
Ania's voice seemed remote, as if she were contemplating something much larger.
No, she said at last. Not in itself.
What are the evolutionary directions, I asked, seeing the red pagoda come closer above us and praying that the conversation would keep my mind off collapsing, rolling back down the 20-some-thousand steps we had climbed.
Just three more worth mentioning, said Ania. Increasing specialization, increasing codependency, and increasing evolvability. All of these are really important, but the last is most so.
How do you mean, kiddo?
I mean that evolution itself evolves. It has to. Evolvability is in itself an inherited survival trait. Systems, living and otherwise, have to learn how to evolve and, to some extent, control the direction and rate of their own evolution. The human species, we were on the verge of doing that 1,000 years ago, and the core took it away from us, at least from most of us.
What do you mean, most of us?
I promise that you'll see in a few days, Raw.
We reached the south gate of heaven and passed through its arched entry, a red arch under a golden pagoda roof. Beyond it was the heavenly way, a gentle slope that ran to the summit that was just visible. The heavenly way was nothing more than path on bare black rock. We could have been walking on an airless moon like old Earth's. The conditions here were about as amenable to life. I started to say something to Ania about this being a niche that life hadn't stuck its foot into, when she led the way off the path to a small stone temple set in among the sharp crags and fissures a few hundred meters below the summit. There was an airlock that looked so ancient it appeared to have come out on one of the earliest seed ships. Amazingly, it worked when she activated the press pad, and the three of us stood in it until it cycled and the inner door opened. We stepped inside. It was a small room, and almost bare except for an ornate bronze pot holding fresh flowers, some sprigs of green on a low dais, and a beautiful statue, once gold, of a life-size woman in robes that appeared to be made of gold. The woman was fat-cheeked and of pleasant demeanor, a sort of female Buddha, and she looked to be wearing a gilded crown of leaves and had an oddly Christian halo of hammered gold behind her head. Abetic pulled off his helmet and said, "The air is good. Air pressure more than adequate." Ania and I folded back our skin suit cowls. It was a pleasure to breathe regularly.
There were incense tapers and a box of matches at the statue's foot. Aenea went to one knee and used a match to light one of the tapers. The smell of incense was very strong. "This is the princess of the azure clouds," she said, smiling up at the smiling gold face. "The goddess of the dawn. By lighting this, I've just made an offering for the birth of grandchildren." I started to smile and then froze. She has a child. My beloved has already had a child. My throat tightened and I looked away, but Aenea walked over and took my arm. "Shall we eat lunch?" she said. I had forgotten about our brown bag lunch. It would have been difficult to eat it through our helmets and osmosis masks. We sat in the dim light, in the windowless room, amid the floating smoke and scent of incense, and ate the sandwiches packed by the monks. "Where now?" I said as Aenea began recycling the inner lock. "I have heard that there is a precipice on the eastern edge of the summit called Suicide Cliff," said A. Betic. "It used to be a place for serious sacrifice. Jumping from it is said to provide instant communion with the Jade Emperor and to ensure that your offering request is honored. If you really want to guarantee grandchildren, you might jump from there." I stared at the android. I was never sure if he had a sense of humor or simply a skewed personality. Aenea laughed. "Let's walk to the temple of the Jade Emperor first," she said. "See if anyone's home." Outside, I was struck first by the isolation of the skin suit and the airless clarity of everything. The osmosis mask had gone almost opaque because of the unfiltered ferocity of the midday sun at this altitude. Shadows were harsh. We were about 50 meters from the summit and the temple when a form stepped out of the blackness of shadow behind a boulder and blocked our way. I thought, "Shrike," and foolishly clenched my hands into fists before I saw what it was. A very tall man stood before us, dressed in lance-slashed vacuum combat armor. Standard Pax Fleet Marine and Swiss Guard issue. I could see his face through the impact-proof visor. His skin was black, his features strong, and his short-cropped hair was white. There were fresh and livid scars on his dark face. His eyes were not friendly. He was carrying a Marine-class multi-purpose assault rifle, and now he raised it and leveled it at us. His transmission was on the skin suit band.
"Stop!"
We stopped. The giant did not seem to know what to do next. "The Pax finally have us," was my first thought. Aenea took a step forward. "Sergeant Gregorius?" came her voice on the skin suit band. The man cocked his head but did not lower the weapon. I had no doubt that the rifle would work perfectly in hard vacuum. Either Fleshette Cloud, Energy Lance, Charged Particle Beam, Solid Slug, or Hyper K. The muzzle was aimed at my beloved's face.
"How do you know my—"
began the giant, and then seemed to rock backward.
"You're her. The one. The girl we sought for so long across so many systems. Aenea."
"Yes," said Aenea. "Are there others who survived?"
"Three,"
said the man she had called Gregorius. He gestured to his right, and I could just make out a black scar on black rock, with blackened remnants of something that might have been a starship escape bulb.
"Is Father Captain DeSoya among them?" said Aenea.
I remembered the name. I remembered DeSoya's voice on the dropship radio when he had found us and saved us from Nemes and then let us go on God's Grove almost 10 of his and Aenea's years ago.
"Aye," said Sergeant Gregorius. "The captain's alive, but just barely. He was burned bad on the poor old Raphael. He'd be Adams with her if he hadn't passed out and given me the opportunity to drag him to a lifeboat. The other two are hurt, but the father captain's dying."
He lowered the rifle and leaned on it wearily.
"Dying the true death. We have no resurrection creche, and the darling father captain made me promise to slag him to Adams when he went, rather than let him be resurrected a mindless idiot."
Aenea nodded. "Can you take me to him? I need to talk to him."
Gregorius shouldered the heavy weapon and looked suspiciously at A. Betic and me.
And these two?
This is my dear friend, said Aenea, touching A. Betic's arm. She took my hand. And this is my beloved. The giant only nodded at this, turned and led the way up the final stretch of slope to the summit, to the temple of the Jade Emperor.